Wait, who's that?
Damn right, it's Shaft. And 50 years ago this summer, actor Richard Roundtree became the epitome of cool as private detective John Shaft. In the 1971 movie Press Kit, Shaft was described as a hard and handsome breed of black man spawned amongst the violence and dangers of the innards of Harlem, in which he moves with self-assured ease. Shockingly bold for 1971, just years after the height of the civil rights movement, Isaac Hayes' score topped the charts. Shut your mouth. The film helped birth the genre of blaxploitation films.
I didn't even introduce myself to you, gentlemen. My name is John Shaft. Freeze.
There would be a short-lived TV series, movie sequels with Samuel L. Jackson as Shaft's nephew, and in 2019, a multi-generational reboot. Jackson, now Shaft's son, Shaft II, his estranged son, Shaft Jr., played by newcomer Jesse Usher, an FBI data analyst, and Grandpa, Richard Roundtree, making return as Shaft, brought out of retirement to help his grandson find the drug kingpin who killed his childhood friend. In this scene, the three Shafts approach a security guard. Roundtree will challenge him to an arm wrestle.
Can I help you, gentlemen?
Yeah, I was telling my boys here that even at my age, I could take you.
Come on, Pop. Hey, you got something better to do?
Sound like to me he calling you out, Holmes. That is, unless you're scared.
Okay.
Come on. Okay.
Of course, Richard Roundtree's Shaft pins him and knocks him out.
Still got it.
We spoke with Richard Roundtree in 2019 and began by asking how he felt when asked to be part of a reboot of Shaft.
I thought it was over in 74 after the TV series. And then I got called back many years later with Sam and kind of underwhelmed with that production. And then they said we're going to do another one, three generations of Shaft. And I read it, and this was a totally different Shaft.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, this is probably going to work. And to my utter surprise, this thing is off the chain.
No kidding. I mean, how did it feel to embody the character again?
Well, honestly, it's much like riding a bike. I mean, it's a comfortable pair of shoes.
Yeah. Well, novelist Ernest Tidyman created Shaft, he has said, as a revolutionary, someone taking things into his own hands. The mythic photographer Gordon Parks made the movie as a symbol of strength and pride.
Gordon Parks is Shaft.
Mm.
The way he moved, the way he talked. He is the most sophisticated, smooth person that I have ever met. And to be in his presence and to be a part of something that he has his stamp on is magical to me.
Gordon Parks was kind of Shaft instead of with a gun, with a camera.
Wow, yeah. You're right.
Black and white camera.
You're
right. Yeah. And this new version, you've said it's different. It is so different. Enter John Shaft Jr., JJ, grows up, you know, in the suburbs with his mother who has left Shaft because of all of the violence in his life. He dresses like a preppy, goes to MIT.
He's a geek.
Okay. Hates guns, has been estranged from Samuel L. Jackson, Shaft, his dad, but now he needs him to help solve a crime. He's conflicted.
I work for the FBI. I can't be aiding and abetting the city's highest profile sociopath as he just tears through Harlem one drug dealer at a time.
Look, you asked for my help. I gave you my help. You don't like the way the sausage is made? Close your eyes when you eat it.
What kind of metaphor is that?
I think what you're trying to say is thank you.
Yeah.
And so JJ needs him. He, in turn, needs you to take down this, you know, horrible crew that's, you know, peddling drugs and causing mayhem. Just talk a little bit about this new young JJ who wants to do things on computers and with apps, and your character doesn't know what he's talking about, who, again, you know, resists guns, is in the FBI but resists sort of the violent side of that work, and then turns towards it. And there is kind of a teasing of him by others in his circle that I think somebody even says, you seem white. You know, I'm a white person talking to you. But there was a little bit of a sense of, Well, what kind of message is that? You know, that it's not cool to be smart and it's not cool to go to MIT? Because, as you know, young African-Americans sometimes struggle with that.
Mm.
You know, that if they do well, they're called geeks and they're called too white. You know, your kind of thoughts on walking that line in the movie.
It's a reality, and you got to get past it. And I've had to walk that line, but I always played by my own rules. And my rules are, you're either right or wrong.
No matter which side of the color equation you're on. I mean,
right.
The thing about Shaft, the original Shaft, was, as it says in the press release, he was this self-confident black man, but he also was comfortable in Whitey's trough, as they put it. And J.J. learns to be the same. But Samuel Jackson has said in the past that he just has a reverence for this role and what you came to mean to the black community, what this character came to mean. And he didn't want him to be reduced.
Buffoonish,
yeah. Did you worry about that in this movie? Because there's a lot of comedy.
No, because I know what Sam is all about. And when I read the script, I didn't get any of that at all.
Yeah. Well, Usher, who's only 27, said he had to do some research to figure out what this is all about. But he did know, as just about every young African-American, I think I can say, knows, that Shaft was a neighborhood hero, that this couldn't be done just for entertainment. As Usher said, we need this. This guy, he's a champion. He has to be respected.
Mm.
What kind of a burden is that for you, having created this character on the screen? I mean, maybe not a burden, a blessing, but what responsibility do you
That's
feel?
The only way I can look at it. I used to look at it as a double-edged sword, you know, but I've had so many people from all over the country and all over the world, actually, come up and say what that film meant to them back in 71. It's heavy, and I'm appreciative of people speaking to me and sharing that with me. The other side of it is I got typecast for quite some time, and I've gone out of my way to establish a different side of my acting. Mm. Even going to playing the first interracial gay couple married on television.
That's right. The series Rock, R-O-C,
right.
That you played a part of a gay couple, played another private detective in City Heat opposite Clint Eastwood, Burt Reynolds. Your beautiful voice is on PlayStation. I mean, and yet Shaft.
Yeah, I that's how far I went. But still, inevitably, whenever I guest on a show, the first day of work, invariably they'll play that theme song.
Right. But on the other hand, you have a brand new, fresh film, fresh young Shaft, Jesse Usher.
Yeah.
And here's, you know, Samuel Jackson, complete womanizer. And there's a scene in which Samuel Jackson threatening a woman with a gun, bad woman. And his son, JJ, says, well, you can't hit a woman. And Samuel Jackson says, why not?
She's got a bat.
She's got a bat. She's going to hit me.
You can't beat up a woman.
Why not?
Because she's a woman. That's like misogynistic.
You the one being misogynistic. I ain't mentioning her gender. You the one bringing up her being a woman. I'm an equal opportunity.
All right. Just, can I handle this?
You do have in this new film, JJ bringing a different sensibility, telling Shaft. Nobody tells Shaft, you know, that he's wrong on certain moral issues. In this film, people do. And Jackson's Shaft seems to have kind of a change of heart on a lot of things by the end.
Yes. I think we covered all the bases with the millennials and the old school attitudes that seemingly have to bend, if you will, mm-hmm. not totally change, but bend, mm-hmm. and realizing that things are changing.
Yeah.
You get to look at how it bridges the three generations. There's a respect across the board.
Yeah. Richard Roundtree, the original Shaft, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Our conversation with Richard Roundtree in 2019. Shaft celebrates 50 years this summer.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of White Supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, October 14, 2021. So I have been told. This is our second book study on Ernest Tidyman's Shaft, published in 1970. So the audio segment that we heard at the beginning, that was from a 2019 interview with Richard Roundtree, the star of the first series of Shaft movies from the 1970s. Black Male was 28. This was his breakout role as Shaft in 1971. So you heard a few things. I'll be brief so that we can go ahead and get to the movie. Mr. Roundtree said that he was typecast, meaning that he could only get specific types of roles for a period that were, I guess, similar to Shaft. He would have to explain a little bit more detail about the similarity in the roles. But he said he had to work really hard to get away from being typecast. And he said in so doing that he took the first role as a gay male in being married to a white man, the first interracial married gay couple on television on the series Rock. Now, this episode aired in October of 1991, so we are literally 30 years almost to the day when the episode, and it's season 1, episode 8, Can't Help Loving That Man. That's what the episode is titled, Can't Help Loving That Man, and you can actually check it out in its entirety on YouTube. Remember Rock, the great Charles S. Dutton? We'll hear a snippet of that as we go out. But just kind of keep that in mind. All the homoeroticism that we talked about last week, butt-cupping steel chair that they had Shaft sitting in, all of that, keep that in mind. The first interracial, so-called, married gay couple on television. And you hear a little bit more. They talk about the 2019 version of the film that came out. You hear them briefly mention Ernest Tidyman, although they do not mention a white man wrote all of this. And they said that Tidyman wrote, conceived of Shaft as a revolutionary who takes things into his own hands, doesn't even need, not mentioning that he's white. Well, I don't know what that means. I'm mindful of the word revolutionary in terms of taking things into his own hands. And then they say that Shaft is a confident black man, comfortable in Harlem, but also comfortable in Whitey's trowel. Now, I don't even know what that means. I had to look that up. It's like a sloth bucket where animals feed. So I don't even, that's explaining that to me. The folks who wrote the press release in 1971 for Shaft, again, that was released July 4th weekend. Anyway, lots more I could say. Just kind of keep that in mind as we proceed. Again, the experiment, ask if you have older parents, uncles, older black people that you know of. Did you know Shaft was based on a book written by a white man? We will hear a very brief snippet from Rock, Can't Help Loving That Man, featuring Richard Roundtree explaining, or coming out, as they say, and then we will get to the text. Context of White Supremacy, Rock first, then the book.
Where's your suitcase?
Oh, I checked into a hotel before I came over.
Why'd you do that? We got plenty of room here for you.
Oh, I know that, but I didn't come alone this trip.
Oh, you dog, you. You seeing someone?
Oh, for the past year or so, yeah.
I knew it. I knew it. The minute he walked in the door, I said, now this man looks too happy and looks too good. He in love.
Yeah, right, right.
See, us women know these things. Does your sweetie pie have a name?
Yes, Chris, but you see...
Oh, if I know my baby brother, this Chris is some looker. Am I right?
Sure you right.
So when do we get to meet?
Soon. Real soon.
But you see, I wanted to talk to you first before you get introduced. You see, there's something I've kept hidden for a long time. From you, even myself. You see, I'm gay. And Chris is a man.
That's nice. How about some coffee? I'll put on a pop.
Hey, Papa, you okay?
Sure I'm okay. Why, aren't I acting okay?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, Russell here just said he was gay.
Oh, for God's sakes, Rock, it's the 90s. Don't you ever watch Oprah?
I'm gonna give him a hand. Would you like anything in yours?
I'd like a little cinnamon.
That figures.
Pop, you sure you're all right?
Hell no, I'm not all right. My baby brother just told me he was gay. How could I be all right? What's the matter with you men?
I know you must be shocked, Pop. I'm not too comfortable with it either. Not about being gay, about Uncle Russell being gay. See, I'm even uncomfortable about being uncomfortable. That's how uncomfortable I am.
Wow, man, Uncle Russell's gay. But hey, he's still the same Uncle Russell, except now we know he's gay. But I mean, he's always been gay, but now we know.
So what's your point, Joey?
Uncle Russell's gay.
I just can't see how a black man can be gay. White people I can understand. Now, they're all descended from no sissy European countries. But a educated, proud black man like Russell, gay? Why would he choose that?
Pop, it's not a matter of black and white.
Three. Knox didn't. He opened the door without a sound and rolled into the office as quietly as a coasting locomotive. And almost as big. He had agreed on midnight. It was midnight. Shaft was impressed by anything, anybody, so huge, could move so quietly. It was an art form in the world where menace was your neighbor, who came knocking at odd hours to borrow a cup of blood. But it was an art in which the masters were usually small, tight men, set closely upon the ground they wished to cover. Shaft knew that he couldn't do it. He was fast, faster than almost anyone he knew, and strong. Stronger than almost anyone he had tried. But he wasn't quiet. He envied persons the capacity of it. That was all he felt as the black giant of Harlem, racketeering, made one of the straight-backed wooden chairs disappear by lowering the hulk of his body upon it. There was an overpowering sense of authority about the man, but no threat to Shaft. Persons wouldn't be there on the chair, wouldn't have tolerated his call or the killing of the intruder that morning, if he did not want Shaft alive for one reason or another. Now, what was it? You alone? Persons asked. I'm alone. He did not have to ask about Persons. Somewhere in the night, in the dregs that remained after the theatergoers had been poured out of Times Square, were Persons' men. In the hallway, on the street, probably even in the fire alley behind the building. Persons was like a pope or a king. He could never be alone in his lofty eminence. Too many people wanted him, or something he had. Shaft looked for Person's eyes, which were tucked away in folds of flesh. So we all look alike, do we? The head of the man was shaven, glistening. The jaw around the full, firm mouth was heavy-boned and hard. Nature had structured Knox Persons to drive through immovable objects and beat back irresistible forces. I got you mad without us ever meeting, Persons said. That was a mistake. Mine. A lot of people I never met make me mad. You so mad you couldn't work for me? If it pays, and you coming in here like any other client, I don't get mad. It pay, and that's how I'm here. Okay, what do you want? Shaft still couldn't find the man's eyes. They lurked there, behind the heavy ridge of the skull at the start of his forehead, shadowing the area between the brows and the large, appropriately strong nose. But while he wondered, he was relaxed. Confronted with the figure of Persons, his abstract anger was pointless. What I want? I want my baby back. And Shaft discovered why he couldn't find the eyes. Persons had been squeezing them tight to fight back the tears that now came trickling down the face of the man. Shaft had a feeling of history, along with some embarrassment. He was watching an epic event in a sordid context. Knox Persons, who got his name from a community because he had taken all the knocks and bumps that anybody could give him without stopping or even slowing down, was crying. That surprised Shaft. It shocked him. Mr. Persons, one of the bare paws waved aside the words and plunged into the folds of the black suit for a crisply white handkerchief that seemed to be about the size of a twin bed sheet. Persons wiped away the tears, stuffed the handkerchief away, and found a long green cigar in an inside pocket. The ritual of the cigar fascinated Shaft. He watched Persons strip off the cellophane, remove the band that had said Havana Upman, one of the pre-Castro cigars that are still around in private humidors of the very wealthy. He knew Persons wouldn't bite the end, and he was pleased to see a hand dip into the change pocket of his suit and come out with a small gold cigar clipper. Shaft also felt an impulse to lean over with a match and light the cigar. He didn't. Persons wasn't fishing for the gesture. He got his own matches, lighted the Havana, and dropped the bit of tobacco and the wrapper into Shaft's ashtray, while the curl of smoke rose around his bald head in a carcinogenic halo. "You're a young man, Mr. Shaft," Persons said, "but you've been around. I just assume you forget what you just saw." Shaft nodded. He'd never forget it, but he'd never mention it. He knew the price of pride. "You know me, and you know what I do. Maybe you even know my baby." It was a question. Shaft knew Persons had a wife, since he had talked with Andrazi about the pay telephone in the closet. But he didn't know baby. Was it a showgirl Persons was keeping? The old bastard looked up to it. "No, I don't know baby." "Maybe you do, but you don't know she's mine. She don't often admit to me. I don't say anything about her. She used her mother's name mostly. Beatrice Thomas is what she called herself, but she's mine." Shaft's memory circuit made no connection to the name. He was about to jot it down on the legal pad at the right of his desk blotter, but stopped himself. Not with Knox Persons. Write nothing down. Give them nothing to read about what you know and what you do. He tapped his teeth with the ballpoint instead. "I don't understand. Is this a girlfriend of yours?" There was pride as well as a concern in the rumble. "Beatrice is my daughter. Even if she don't like to admit it, she's my baby." She was 19 now, a pretty one from what Knox saw of her, and what they had told him about how she looked. She'd grown up so fast. And so furiously. Why, Knox said, he could remember when she actually was a baby. Not like he just called her that now. About as big as a button when she was born, and she never seemed to be wanting to grow much bigger. In those early days, Knox Persons remembered, he could almost hold her in one hand. He had been holding her, in fact, when the law came busting through the door and said he had to go away with them for questioning. He got back 5 years later, and she was a sassy, bright little girl, easily frightened by strangers. Baby was going to school with the nuns, and her name was Beatrice Thomas, because that's what her mother said it was. "No little girl of mine is going to school with no jailbird name on it," she said. But she was his little girl too, wasn't she? "Not anymore, Mr. Persons," she had said. "You got your business, and your police, and your jails, and there's no room in that for a little girl like her." Maybe the woman was right. Maybe she wasn't, but the day she told him, he left their apartment just east of Amsterdam Avenue to go back to repairing the battlements of his empire. He turned the ignition key and saw the front end of his new Coupe de Ville disappear in a roar that left him deaf for 2 days, bleeding for 3, dedicated for all time to having a chauffeur turn the key for him. If that's the way it was going to be, little Beatrice Thomas had probably best go on just being just that. There were many things to do for Knox Pearsons as he took control of the policy racket, the bookies, the floating action for the high-rolling crapshooters, the hustlers, and the men who hustled them. He even went so far as to take one of the women, a beautiful light-skinned dancer, under his widening sphere. But there was only one baby. He kept further away from her than he did from legality. He sent money, clothes, presents. He even saw that her mother's companions were respectable, gentlemanly, abstemious, and terrorized of saying or doing the wrong thing in the girl's presence. Once a week, he went into the closet to pick up the phone and get a dime's worth of information about Baby. It was all he could stand. She was 14, he said, when she learned who she was and who he wasn't. The words that described him were only in the periphery of her vocabulary as a child guided carefully through the ghetto streets to parochial schools, her mother's idea of the best possible insulation. But Beatrice was smart and learned their meaning quickly. With it, she discovered that she was not just an upper-middle-class Negro girl whose widowed mother had investments that supported them. Not just a girl faced with the identity conflicts of the place and time in which she found herself. She was the child of the worst of men, and even he had rejected her. She just went wild, Person said. She wouldn't go back to school. Too shame. Her mama tell me she wouldn't even talk, just cry or look out the window. All his presence failed to touch the hidden horror of her discovery, which had come as simply as a schoolmate's bit of teasing. Her mother's entreaties failed, too. A visit from the Monsignor in charge of her school evoked only hysterical weeping. I finally went to see her myself. I had to. She screamed when I told her who I was. She screamed a lot of things. The only one that made any sense was she kept calling me the devil. 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 Over and over, when I couldn't look or listen anymore, she said one thing more. She said she was going to join me in hell. She did. By the time she was 16, Beatrice was known in every bar Person's owned, and many he didn't. By 17, she knew every pusher on his payroll. By 18, she had undergone 2 abortions, the drying out procedure in private institutions in 4 different countries. Now she was 19. And I can't find her, Knox Person said, anywhere. It took the big man an hour to complete his doleful recital. Shaft interrupted rarely, then with a simple question. Where did it happen? Rome. Who was the man? That Brazilian fighter, boy named Luis Pinari, something like that. The one who died in the car? Persons would nod and go on. His was a business of harsh realities. Shaft knew, and he had the feeling that he was being involved in 2 private nightmares that had no connection to his life. There was a measure of how far he'd come from Harlem in the fact that he had not heard any of this before. None of the underground whispers about the private shame and sorrow of Big Knox Persons. Who the hell had he been talking to? He asked himself. Shit, if she did half of what Persons said she did, he'd probably run into her 2 or 3 dozen times at parties. When he'd been pursuing somebody like Ellie. He tried to recall freaked-out-looking Negro girls who had caught his attention. He remembered too many. They were all over the place, like the fat-thighed Bronx bagel babies who shaved off their mustaches on Saturday night and flocked down to McDougal Street. He had tried a taste of both. Who could remember the faces and the bodies, let alone the names? She could have been one of them. You had her watched, didn't you? Persons dropped the dead butt of the cigar into the ashtray and reached into the folds of the suit for another, as much as I could. That makes her a hard girl to lose track of, even in a crowded city. Persons was repeating the ritual of the cigar. It occurred to Shaft that the Havana was about the size of a small corn cob. It just looked normal in Persons' hands. I thought so, too. He puffed and looked at the coal end of the smoking length of the hawser. But there's some places my people don't go. Well, how long has she been out of sight? 2 weeks. No word, no hint, nothing. When I say my people looked, they looked. Shaft could imagine every rock in Harlem being turned over. What they must have found along the way. One of those nice, well-meaning social workers once asked him what he wanted to be in the world. Alive, he told her. The only place to stay that way was frequently under one of those rocks at the bottom of the swamp. Survival was a dark place, a black place. That's why I sent for. That's why I come to you. A 19-year-old Negro girl in a frenzy of drink, drugs, and sex, and beautiful too, or so he said. She should be easier to find than a cigarette in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Shaft did not quite understand what had happened between Beatrice Thomas and her father. persons might have screwed the little girl's head on straight with just one swipe of those huge paws. At least it would have told her that her father was a man, which is more than many girls in Harlem known about their fathers by the time they were in high school. At least it would have showed her that he cared enough to be hurt by her, so deeply that he had to strike out at her. Shaft also wondered why the old man had continued to tolerate the relationship of pain and punishment between himself and his daughter. Why hadn't he cut her off? Persons should have been capable of that. He was probably harder inside and out than anyone Shaft knew or cared to know. And Shaft considered the possible fatal course of telling Persons that the best thing he could do was to say good riddance to Beatrice, to thank his good fortune that she was gone to whatever private hell she sought out. Shaft also considered sending Persons on his way. The hate that came with most of his cases, husbands and wives hating husbands and wives, insurance companies hating claims, stores hating thieves, all of that was relatively simple and clear. But this one had too many elements of love to be all that precise and clear in the route from A, the problem, to B, the solution. Beatrice Thomas was bad news. She was not likely to be anything else to John Shaft, investigator of her disappearance, especially since her father, with all his connections and contacts, had not been able to find a trace of her. Mr. Persons, the first thing an honest private detective has got to tell you is that the best place to go right now is to the Missing Persons Bureau of the New York City Police Department. They know who's been carried into the hospitals, who's been carried into the morgue. With them, it's a system, something they do every day. If anything has happened to Beatrice, they'll know about it. Next, if you push them a little to find out she's been seen, who she's been seen with, and if there is anything to follow in that direction. Shaft let the words trail off. He must be out of his mind, suggesting that Knox Persons go to the police. All Persons had to do was lift the corner of the carpet. He'd find the police sitting there taking notes, listening, watching. He would get about as much sympathy from them, as much help and understanding, as a housewife wastes on a bedbug swimming across a clean sheet. The police had been trying to get Knox Persons in a vulnerable position for 3 decades. They would only welcome this discomfort and probably attempt to use it. No, he knew Persons couldn't go to the police. Knox knew it too. That's why he was there with Shaft. I tell you, Mr. Shaft, I tell you, if there was another way, I'd go. The last thing I want is somebody, anyone, anywhere poking around in my business. And it's all right for you to sit there and think it shouldn't matter that much, that I should just go on my way, do what I have to do while the little girl is gone. Well, it don't matter. It don't matter who understands. All I know is now that she's gone like this, I can't think of anything else. I can't do anything else except try to get her back. Get her back where I can kind of watch over her in my own way until she gets all this straightened out. And you, you're a black man. Somewhere inside you, you know what this girl's feeling and what she's thinking. But you're also part of white man because of what you do and where you've been. And you're smart enough to go back and forth between black and white man. That's why I'm asking you to do. I want you to think for me about this little girl. And I want you to go back and forth between being a black man and a white man. And find her for me. It ain't going to hurt you none, and I got some ways to make it help you a whole lot to do that for me. Shaft had been called many things, even Tom by some belligerent separatists. He had never been called a white man before. But he knew. Persons, so black in his own way, understood the dichotomy. And yes, Persons also had many things he could do for Shaft. Most of them had Benjamin Franklin's picture engraved on them and were stuffed into his wallet. Yet Shaft felt uneasy about becoming involved with Persons. It was a healthy attitude. Persons was an impossible man to control. He was a figure standing alone on a foundation of corruption. His identity could be part of Shaft's identity, at least in the eyes of the police with whom Shaft dealt. Yet his power would also become part of Shaft's power. Realistic about its seductive quality, wary of the chains, he was fascinated by the idea. He was also intrigued by the idea that Beatrice could disappear and all the king's men couldn't find her. Could he? Why not? Better than they could. He could do what was necessary. If I decide to give it a try, I need two things from you. How much? Not money yet. We'll get to that in a minute. What I need is your promise that there won't be any more shit like this morning. It's you sending people after me, people with guns. If I work for you, I'll work for you. And you'll get the same straight, ethical deal that any other client gets when he walks into this office. But there can't be anybody behind me or waiting in front of me where I can trip over them and have them mess up my play. I'll tell you right now, if you ever send anybody after me again, I'm going to kill the motherfuckers, and then I'm going to come looking for you. The old man didn't even blink his hooded yellow eyes. He may have even nodded slightly in agreement. Shaft wasn't sure. The other thing is, you have to tell me the truth about everything I ask. It's never going beyond this room or this head, but I have to know everything I can that seems necessary to doing this thing, whether you want to tell me or not. I won't write anything down, and nobody will know what I know. And it may seem crazy to you that I want to know, but it's part of it. It's one of the tools of the job. It's one I have to have if I'm going to do it right. Persons might well have been disturbed at the suggestion that we'd have to open up some of the dark corners of his mind to Shaft's probing at the price of regaining communication with his daughter. But he did not debate it very long. He looked at Shaft in silence for a few moments and dispensed with the matter, moved on to the next. How much money do you want? How much money did Shaft want? It was a beautiful question. He wanted all the money. He wanted every fucking penny that had ever been minted or printed. He wanted all the money he could possibly use, all the money he could luxuriate. Knox Pearson's had it, and Shaft could probably get at it. It wasn't like any other case. These weren't real people. Goddamn, there was only one way to go. There never was more than one way to go, even now. My rate will figure out to be about $12 an hour. Which is about the average, maybe a little under the average for a private eye in New York. You'll have to take my word for all the expenses. What I mean when I say expenses is, if I have to rent a car, I'm just going to go ahead and do it without worrying about it. When I do, it's on a 24-hour basis, and maybe I'll have to abandon the damn thing someplace, and there'll be a charge for bringing it back to the garage. Things like that. If I have to buy information for $100 or so, I'm going to have to use my own judgment on how much it's worth and how badly we need it. Beatrice has been a lot of fancy places. If I have to go there for one reason or another, I have to go there first class. That's part of the expenses. I can't go anywhere looking like a cop. It may cost a few dollars keeping me from looking like one. Knox interrupted him. I don't care about any of that, he said, reaching to the left inside pocket of his coat for a fat yellow envelope. He flipped it casually, with hardly a movement of his huge body, onto the desk blotter in front of Shaft. It was casual, but it was not insulting. Just the person's way. When that's gone, you let me know when you need. Shaft picked up the envelope, hefted it for a moment in his right hand, and frowned at it. He considered opening it, writing Knox Pearson's a receipt in the customary manner, and putting its contents aside for deposit in his bank account. But that would not be to Pearson's liking, writing numbers and names on paper. There was enough there. There would always be enough there when Pearson stuffed an envelope. Shaft stuck it into his own coat, feeling it bulge and nestle against the flat muscle of his chest. It felt even larger there than it had in his hand. It probably made him look as if he were carrying a cannon, a piece, heat. All right, he said. When that's gone, I'll let you know. Now, I need some facts. Not emotion. Now I need truth. Shaft was starved. The fact that he had not eaten struck him when he walked out of the building and into Times Square. The glitter of Pearson's Cadillac limousine, a black Fleetwood, had already vanished among the sequins of the night. It was another sparkling dot among a million or two just like it, somewhere speeding the big man back to his castle. Damn, but he was hungry. He barely looked at the worn wax faces that Times Square was wearing. He wanted a hot dog. He also wanted to sleep. He turned south towards 43rd Street and Benedict's to stand over on the 7th Avenue side of the square. There were three or four hustlers there, a couple of pimply kids with scraggly mustaches, two or three black cats in hip-length leather black coats and bobber hats. They didn't pay any attention to him, and he returned the compliment of acceptance. The orange juice was ice cold and tasted of rind. The hot dog was hot and tasted of the garlic that had been added to obscure the meat. He had to go to Harlem. He had to go, but he didn't want to. Shaft had not really considered the two faces on the coin of his world until persons had put it back to him with the astuteness of his own black identity. Shaft was black, persons had said, but he was also white. Was he, really? His world was both worlds. He wondered how well he had made the transition, and in fact, what changes had come to him that had made it so simple for persons to label him a mutation. He had to go to Harlem. He had to go find some of the people who hated Knox persons and ask them just how badly they hated. That's $1.90, mister. $1.90 for what? That's 7 hot dogs with 20 cents a hot dog and 50 cents for the orange juice. What's 7 hot dogs? Mister, you ate 7 hot dogs. 7 hot dogs. Shaft felt the bulge of his stomach muscles at the belt. He'd been standing there, thinking, and apparently he had gorged on 7 of the long red cylinders of meat and miscellany off the greasy grill. 7 hot dogs. That was pretty good. For a second, he felt rather proud of himself. He was full, but he wished he could remember eating them. He handed the nervous Puerto Rican counterman $2. Okay, he said. What's so unusual about 7 hot dogs? The Puerto Rican smiled at him, rang up the $1.90. Shaft belched. Whoosh. 7 hot dogs. He wished he could remember eating them. He wondered if people ever actually exploded. He'd never read about that happening. 4. Ben Buford's voice was in a magnificent thing. It could crackle with the lightning of anger, keen with the sorrow of exhortation and spiritual need, thunder with the depths of profundity and meaning. It was a thing apart from the man who stood Watutsi tall and warrior fierce in his stance, so tall and lean with a great bush of tight black curls surrounding his slender ascetic face, his arms and legs so slim and long that even the suits he affected were not quite enough to cloak the angularity of his body. He did not look at all like his voice, a warrior or an inflamed divinity student with gold-rimmed glasses perched on his nose. But when the chorus of his voice sounded, his audiences saw something more than the man who was evident to them outwardly. They heard and saw the man who was there in Detroit when it was burning, in Watts when it was burning, in Bedford-Stuyvesant when it was burning. They heard and saw the man who was out front for them when the time came to light the fires, to pick up the guns, to go to the rooftops and let it happen. And Buford knew exactly what he was, what that voice meant, and what he meant. There were 4 men with him in the room over Amsterdam Avenue in the middle of the afternoon of Manhattan. 3 of them were very much like himself, tall, perhaps a little more muscular, crowned with the black afro bushes of hair, stern, pure, intense. The 4th was a short, flashily dressed black man whose hair was straight and pomaded, whose suit was Italian and whose shoes were $60 alligator loafers. He was frightened, and he wasn't sure why. The police didn't frighten him. Narcs didn't frighten him. His own customers, who were capable of killing a man for a lot less than he usually carried, didn't frighten him either. But Ben Buford did. The tall, angular man who had suddenly pointed a long, bony finger in his face and that voice that was now thundering at him. God damn you, you motherfucker! I am dying for you. Now you get your ass out of here and you get me what I need and you get it back here by 4 o'clock. That's when I need it. You, go! Frightened. Still not sure why he was frightened, he got up to leave the room. I'm going to try, Ben. I'm going to try. His assurance was as shaky as the knotted muscles of his gut. You try. You do that. You get back here by 4. The man left. The eyes of the others were on Buford. They watched his frozen mask of authority melt into a smile. You want to bet he gets back here with that shit? They smiled. It was no bet. The man, the pusher, would be back and would have what Ben Buford needed and wanted before he set off again on another of his tours through the country. Ben took a chair at the head of the battered red maple table that was just about the only furniture in the small drab room. The others took places around him. They did not defer too obviously. It was much too cool for that. But when he moved, they also moved, about a half a second afterwards, always to a place just a few inches behind or below. He was the leader. They were the core, This was the revolution. What did the lawyer say? He wants you to call him, Ben. What the hell for? He says you probably got to go down to Atlanta and go to court yourself this time. Shit. Maybe it's not so bad, Ben. You could hit maybe 6, even 10 schools along the way. The brothers need to hear you, see you. That was Lonnie Dots. I was pushing him into the clutch of some fool students who thought the barricades were made of books, thought they were going to drown Whitey in their cans of beer. Figured they could back his play just by listening, yelling, crying out, "Tell it like it is, Ben!" It was a drag. It was better here in the ghetto. Here they knew what it was all about. They lived with it. It ground them down. They paid the fucking dues just to stay alive. It wasn't an intellectual adventure. It was the bedbugs that got you in the night and the garbage stink that singed your nostrils in the heat of the day. Atlanta. That judge wanted to send his ass to jail as soon as possible, as long as possible, as legal as possible. Cat's coming up here to see me. The others looked a little surprised. They had had the room only 4 days. They had been convinced that no one knew of it or that Ben Buford was using it. That was the scheme. 3 days here, 4 days there. Never sit still. Keep finding places for Ben. Keep the FBI moving. Keep the CIA moving. Keep Ben moving, all in different directions. Sometimes he needed a good rest and a woman. They would check into a Statler Hilton for 4 or 5 days without any attempt to hide. He could meet the press, give interviews, get his picture taken, talk to the magazine people, do everything in big, flashy, public way, so everybody would know he wasn't trying to hide, that he was really out front. Then he would disappear back into the little rooms, ever-changing, but always the same, with a few rickety pieces of furniture, a rob bulb glaring out of a dangling socket that hung like a noose from the aged, stained ceiling. This was where the work was done. The three young men sitting with Ben Buford were his Praetorian Guard, his administrative council, his friends, and the very closest of his associates. Longford Dots, who was called the Minister of Information, Bayman Newfield, his program director, Preston Pierce, who was known as field secretary of the organization and who spoke for Ben Buford when he wasn't there, his second in command. They had locked themselves together into a struggle they called the revolution and were inseparably bound by the consequences of the decision. Actually, they did not trust each other very much in general, and specifically, his three associates did not trust Ben Buford, and he was not entirely open with them. They were all working on the knowledge that messiahs come and go with frequency in revolutions. This one, a small fire attempted in a heavy rain, used them like stick matches, each one striking a brief flash of fire before it sputtered out and grew cold. Buford could see ambition in the others, ambition and envy. He could see something of the same in him, although not much of the envy. He held the chair and had the presence. It was a clear and unmistakable stamp, the capacity of Buford's to express authority and leadership. He worked with it, used it, and had been uplifted by that recognition when he spoke to the sea of faces in a university audience. He had the presence. He was the man, and they had no alternative at the moment. Buford had said he would die for them, for all of them. He meant it. To stand with him meant the same aspiration for the rest of them. That was the price of the revolutionaries' power. Those were the dues that you paid with them. "Who's this cat coming up?" Lonnie Dots asked. "Told you, cat I used to know." How Buford had arranged the meeting was unknown to them. He'd stopped at a pay telephone booth about 2 or 3 hours early and made about 15 or 20 phone calls, a number of them long distance. He had told them of some of the calls he had made, some of the arrangements he had agreed to, but he had not told them of all the calls, not the ones that had arranged this meeting with John Shaft. In this spotted, stained center of their struggle, it was not the place of a follower to ask the leader what he did not care to divulge. They just looked at him and tried to pry it out of him with the hard pressure of their eyes. They failed. How could the leader of a revolution explain that he had called his mother from the barricades, or that he called her every night and told her not to worry? Fuck the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and all their phone books. "Ben?" Her voice was warm and full of pride. "I almost forget to tell you. At nights, Johnny Shaft you used to play with. He called here looking for you. He say he have to talk with you." He's such a nice boy. I remember how you and he always together. He say he riding around in a taxi cab looking for you because he got to find you about something important. I knows you wouldn't mind me telling him you was in town. She paused, uncertain of his reaction. He said nothing. I guess you wants to see him as much as he wants to see you, being as how you two are such good friends. He gonna call you back in 10 minutes. Where should I tell him to meet you? How also could he tell his mother that he no longer had any friends? Being gone, being in the papers all the time, calling at all these crazy hours, that was enough for her. She knew of no revolution. He gave her the address to give John Shaft, and damned the smart motherfucker to a private hell for knowing him so well. But what the hell did he want? Shaft had no business with them. Shaft was what? Shaft was one of the opportunists, the bastards who could hustle both sides of the street. Now there was a son of a bitch who couldn't be trusted. Shaft was a pimp for the whores of whiteness and smart. He would have to be careful, more careful than with Lonnie Dots, Bayman Newfield, or Preston Pierce, who were ready to crack open those crates, take the pieces, and go to the rooftops to die with him. The object of Buford's anger and suspicion was at that moment asleep. Shaft lay jammed into the rear right corner of a battered taxicab rolling up Amsterdam Avenue past the empty shells of streets. He was wedged into the corner, his legs out along the seat, and across to the other side behind the back of the driver, his head askew, bent to one side against the glass, his chin down on his chest. Shaft pouted when he slept. He looked like a truculent 9-year-old squeezing his eyes shut in protest. But not to the driver of the cab. To him, Shaft was a menace, a nut spade he'd picked up in Times Square and which he had never seen. The cab rolled up one of the last hills of Washington Heights, at the north end of Manhattan, past Yeshiva University, and came to a stop at the corner of 198th Street. The driver paused under a streetlight, turned to Shaft, and puzzled over the sleepy Negro for a moment. "Hey, buddy," he said it pretty loud. He didn't have to. Shaft's eyes were open the moment the rhythms of the cab's movement along the shattered pavement of Amsterdam had stopped. He was awake and completely aware, but he didn't move. He didn't want to frighten the cab driver any more than he already had. The meter showed $6.35. "This 198th in Amsterdam?" "That's right, buddy. This is where you wanted to go." Relief in the cabbie's voice. Maybe the spade would get out of here. Maybe the black man would go away without robbing him. He could go back to hustling short hauls in Times Square and the Upper East Side and maybe a trip to LaGuardia or Kennedy. And he could just forget about going into neighborhoods like this at this hour of night with a black passenger. What the hell did he pick him up for anyway? He could kick himself in the ass. Shaft wasn't going anywhere. He caught a piece of light shining into the cab from the Blue Street arc and held it on his watch. 3 o'clock. Still an hour. He could still use some more sleep. "So how long do you think it would take to get from here down to Battery Park and then back to 198th Street in Amsterdam?" "Aw, come on, mister. Is this some kind of game? You want me to just ride around? Why don't you take a bus?" "Too much light. You think it'd take an hour?" "What?" "Driving to Battery Park and back to 198th in Amsterdam. It would take about an hour." Resigned, he was going to Battery Park. He wondered if this character would hold him up down there or wait until they got back to Harlem. Should he risk his life attempting to attract the attention of a cop or just go along quietly and attempt to hide his watch under the seat along the way? Shaft felt a little sorry for the driver. He was an inoffensive man in most ways, except that he was a Jew. Shaft could reason about Jews, and he knew full conviction what his reason told him, but he did not like it. They were in his Harlem childhood, in the candy stores, in the clothes stores, in the little grocery store, in the little liquor store, and in the hock shop, the money store. He hadn't liked them at all in any of those places, or the way they had treated him, or the way they had treated anyone else. They were the merchants of misery, and the feeling would not leave him, no matter how many Jews he knew and liked. But the cab driver's offense of being Jewish was hardly anything to inspire Shaft's desire to torment him. He disliked Jews, but he hated cab drivers. The fact was simply that he had an hour to kill, and the back end of a cab was the place to kill it. The best possible place he could think of to sleep. "Okay," he said. Burst to Battery Park and wake me up so I can see the Statue of Liberty. I want to wave at the old whore. You shouldn't talk like that. I know. Drive. Shaft refolded his arms across his chest and went back to sleep. The driver of the cab sighed, put the car in gear, and turned up 199th Street to pick up St. Nicholas Avenue and eventually the West Side Drive. Might as well take a nice ride down to the river before the black bastard cut his throat and took his money. He was too preoccupied to notice the black Pontiac sedan that moved behind them and followed them through the empty streets in the vacuum of the night, carefully, but definitely. It was a long night for Victor Andreozzi. Time lost its continuum for him now and then. He was getting old, getting bored. He would be finishing up a report, come to the point where it demanded the date and the time, and glance at his watch. Jesus Christ, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. A moment ago, it was only 7 in the evening, and he had lost most of the hours in between. He should be grateful for reports that demanded the date and time. It made him keep track. Or they kept track of him. Years ago, he had wondered about his wife and children in those broken hours of darkness. Now he assumed they were all right, and that somebody would tell him if they were not. He felt now as if that part of his life did not exist, as though it had vanished along with the sequence of time. Christ, it was 3:30 in the goddamn morning, and he had to go see the commissioner of police. He reached for the telephone. Hey, Charlie, get a car. Going downtown. What? Andreozzi asked as he pulled on his short brown raincoat. It was a police commissioner in a city this size doing out of bed this time of night. He also thought of the answer. He was sitting in his office at that moment, a bald little bundle of melancholia and frustration about his own authority and the 30,000 men who were supposed to be in his charge, the unrest of the community, and the limits of his capacity to apply one to the other. There were departments within departments, wheels within wheels. Who was actually in charge of the police department might be a matter of conjecture from day to day. The commissioner represented the political control of the department. He spoke for the mayor. The mayor spoke for the people. Yet the mayor represented himself, a man trapped in a sea of urban agony by his ambitions for public office, his current one being the least of them. The mayor spoke for himself and his ambitions insofar as a public acceptability made it possible. Oh, hell, it was all garbage. Andreozzi was annoyed with himself for thinking about it. The cops were for the cops, the politicians for the politicians, the people for themselves. That's how it broke down, pulverized. Everybody for himself. They were all caught in this whole screwed up period of testing and rejecting authority, of everybody trying to kill his old man in one way or the other. It was no surprise to him that people left the country to go live in France or the Caribbean islands. He wished he could. It was no wonder so many cops bought chicken farms out in the sticks. They were dismal failures as farmers, but at least they had a few years of escape from the constant struggle. He had no escape. He was honest. That would keep him poor. And he hated chickens. The commissioner's secretary was there too, a nice-looking woman of about 40, Jewish. Andreozzi liked dark women, like his wife. Even the faint shadow of a mustache was intriguing, sensual to him. He liked hair, black eyes. He liked this woman. Get him a cup of coffee. How do you take it? Black? Black, Andreozzi said, thinking about the secretary and not the coffee. The commissioner was there at 4 o'clock. She was there at 4. She wasn't his secretary. She wasn't his wife, the Jewish mother of them all. Why shouldn't she be there? He needed her, didn't he? Dark women were like that. He needed them, God damn it, they were there. His wife was like that. She put the old-fashioned white pottery mug down on the coaster in front of him on the edge of the commissioner's desk. Andreozzi picked it up and let the hot, fragrant fumes reach up his hawk-beak nose. He sipped tentatively. What does it look like, Vic? Peering at him over his own steaming mug, the commissioner had great eyes. They nailed you to the wall. They looked right through you, punching holes as they went. Eyes. He had spikes for eyes. He could cut you with them. Short, bald, mean, tough little son of a bitch. I'm not entirely sure this is a race thing, Andreozzi said, assuming they both knew why the commissioner had summoned him. Not the kind of race thing I've seen before. It's something different. Well, the commissioner suggested happily, They're off on their own little internecine warfare of their own. I'm not sure, but let me tell you what I think, and let me tell you what I know. Maybe somewhere between those are the facts that we are working with here. Maybe we'll have some of the answers when City Hall starts throwing some of the questions. I better have all the answers. You'll have all I have. I know that, Vic. I'm sorry. I didn't mean the way it came out. But I don't want to be the police commissioner in a city that has to spray tear gas on the streets from helicopters where the National Guard is shooting up old broads who are looking out the window to see what is going on. Go ahead and tell me. Tell me what you know. And then tell me what you think. Well, I know, we know, that the militants up there are about 6 months from being ready. They already have the guns, or they soon will have. The estimates are that at least 100 weapons a week have been accumulated, stored, made ready at various points over the last 4 years. I think the estimate is low, very low. Well, at any rate, that's the estimate we got. FBI, CIA, NSA. That many guns is a hell of a lot. In this city, I'd quit trying to count them. There's plenty to go around. So, they have a sufficient number of guns, ammunition too. This disappeared in a greater variety amount in the last 2 years than any time in history of the records we keep. This is being stockpiled somewhere, or the North Vietnamese must have been stealing it. How does it break down? In military terms, it's fairly unsophisticated. One-third in handguns, one-third in rifles, the remaining third of it in shotguns, grenades, a few bazookas, some machine guns, maybe a mortar. Who the hell cares about military terms when this hits the streets? The day when we react so that we speak in military terms is going to be a war, not a community crisis. The commissioner was desperate for a definition of the problem. Tanks would roll down the streets of this town. There would be a war, not a shootout. What a fucking mess, the commissioner conceded. Yes, Andreozzi said. Yes. What's the best guess on how much of it can be located? Do we know where it is? We don't. But the other figures, they can get about half of it. Pick it up instantly. Grab it, seal it off, blow it to hell and make it unusable. The other half is in mattresses, in the backs of television sets, and lamp bases, in the flour cans and toilet tanks, in the earth, in the walls, in every goddamn place you can possibly imagine. They sat for a moment in silence, and the commissioner stabbed angrily at one of the buttons on his desk. The door behind Andreozzi opened silently with a push of air against the back of his neck. Get us some coffee, Sylvie, will you? You too, Lieutenant, she said, bending over his coffee cup, smiling warmly, subtly. Comfortingly. All the dark ones had that compassion, except the screwed up career ones. But he liked them too, just on the basis of the look. Me too. I want to tear out every goddamn room north of 59th Street. The commissioner slapped his fat little fist down on the blotter top of the big mahogany desk that was once occupied by Theodore Roosevelt, who would have and could have searched every goddamn room north of 59th Street. You'd need an army for that too. Andreozzi remarked. Okay, what else do you know? Commissioner, if you don't mind, what the hell are you doing up at 4 o'clock in the morning? I am up at 4 o'clock in the morning because the goddamn mayor didn't get home till 2 o'clock in the morning and decided it was a good time to pick up the telephone and call me. He heard talk at the party where he'd been dancing that things in Harlem were on the way up and he wanted to know what I knew. And he said he wanted to know in detail again in the morning. We also know, Andreozzi went on, that the major problem is recruiting, that they just don't have enough fingers for all those triggers. That's at least one area where we get total agreement from the federal people, who give it about 6 months when everybody figures to be ready. That's when the Muslims, the Panthers, the militants, the whole collection of them will come to a sufficient number of angry, organized, and partially trained force to at least attempt a revolution. Andreozzi had never said those words before. He had thought them. So had the commissioner. But they never had been said straight without the cloak of euphemism, conjecture, doubt. Having said them, Andreozzi realized how much he believed and had believed them during the months of investigating, probing, attempting to penetrate. He was not afraid. He had been too long in the business for that. But he felt so frustrated and sorrowful at this knowledge of his, of the events to come. What kind of informers do you get to rap like this? The commissioner asked, leaning back in the big brown leather chair, his gleaming bald head barely touching the plump top of it. The same kind as on anything else. The people who don't want it to happen, the frightened ones, the people who want it to be on the side that wins, the rotten ones, the people we plant there, the working ones, same bunch. The same ones you get on anything else. All right. Now tell me what you think. I think we're lucky to have made a connection with Shaft, as tenuous as it may be. He's that Spade private eye. Yeah, he's that Spade private eye. He's also kind of a friend of mine and a very ruthless, ambitious guy. I put a lot of faith. Maybe I put 60 or 70% faith in the information he'll give. What I also think, Andrazi said, is that this thing is more racket than racial. I mean, it's more our problem, strictly a cop problem, than we think it is. More our problem than a social one. Why? Knox Persons. He doesn't figure to be the focal point or even the peripheral figure in anything racial. Why not? He's rackets, but he's black. And anything black is racial now. Agreed. But he's never been involved in anything that so much as suggested that he wanted to change Harlem or the white community or anything else. His whole life, his whole world is built on the attitudes that made the opportunity for him to function. If anything, Persons would have to be a reverse racist. He probably has a deeper appreciation of the status quo than Lester Maddox or George Wallace. He couldn't prosper in anything but a tight black community with its corruptible white cops on the take and the whole feeling that it's all right to go ahead and do those black things like shoot craps, drink gin, play the numbers, just so you do them on the side of the line. So his presence negates the racial angle, at least to me. But you don't know what is involved. What isn't? No, not yet. But if Knox is part of a threat to bloody up the streets, it would figure that somebody is trying to take something away from him, to crack open that tight little community of crap shooters and gin drinkers.
Context of white supremacy. What in the world? Like, I am aghast. Like, this is kind of like the movie Shaft, kind of, but not exactly. Like, it's I don't even know how to explain it, even really. Like, it's kind of like the movie, and then it's kind of not like the movie. Like, I don't even, the number is 720-716-7300. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. All that jazz about Andrazi and him and the dark. whoa. I almost had to, like, wait a minute. Time out. Like, whoa. Let me get myself together. Like, what is going on? That is not in the movie. Like, you know, what is going on here? Woo! Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The email address untiljustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Let's see. We had a person who emailed in. I reckon go about that first, and then I'll get folks who dialed in as well. Let's see. Person who I can't even get my mouth to stop. I should have just went to call us first. Get your composer. Don't act a fool on the live broadcast. Freaking Ernest Tidyman. The person who wrote in, and she says, Man, not knowing that white people write these things, my gosh. She emailed me even before we got to the session. She says, what I find fascinating is that the author is a white man. The author is a white man. It made me think about some of the things non-white people say and who the originators of the sayings are, such as vaccine hesitancy, toxic masculinity, and the rest with black males. Toxic black masculinity also. She continues, it made me think about some of the things non-white people are programmed to repeat, such as, oh, we just heard vaccine hesitancy, toxic masculinity, black people are homophobic, etc. The script has been written and we follow it to the letter, forgive the metaphor, without doing the proper research to see where the sayings originated and why. So important. Man, can't be said enough, especially with this kooky, wacky book. Jesus Lord. I'm gonna hush there because this is just so crazy. Like, some of this is not the flipping movie at all. Like, yeah, we'll just get to the callers and I'll stop giggling and acting a fool and see what folks thought of the first audio session of Shaft. My goodness. Oh, wait a minute. I have one more thing to share. Sorry. I emailed, there's a non-white person, a victim. He wrote a thesis on Shaft, which many people did, I'm sure. He did a thesis on Shaft, and I asked him to see if I could get a copy of it, because I was more than willing to put the time in to read it to see what he talked about. He said he didn't have a copy of the thesis, like, on a hard drive or whatever. This was some years ago. But he said, hey, if you have any questions as you all are going through, feel free to email. So I emailed him and said, hey, we've only read the first couple chapters, and many of the listeners were stunned. I think some folks said, man, is Ernest Tidyman gay? From what we read last week, like the butt cupping grip of the steel chair and fag this and Shab makes the false proposition to meet this gay white man in a bathroom. And I mean, just Shab, like all of it, just like, what is going on? So I email him and I say, hey, do you know, does anybody have like an analysis of like, why would a white man write a book that is so obsessed with black sexuality, black masculinity, all of this homoeroticism? Like, do you know anyone who's done, you know, any research on this? This reminds me of like Donald Sterling and Vincent Woodard's work, The Delectable Negro. He emailed me back one sentence. He said, there's nothing. There is none that I know of. That was the entire email. There is none that I know of, meaning no analysis, no research about all of this. We've only heard like three chapters, really. Let's see. Folks who dialed in. I'm aghast. Like, I'm absolutely aghast. Let me see. Folks who dialed in with a hand up. Let's see. Helen in New York, see you, and then I'll nab other folks as I see hands.
Greetings, Gus, the listeners, and to the callers. Helen B. here. This book reads like a sexual fantasy novel, and every other line, for lack of a better term, every other line is more sexual than the last one. Trickle down, plunge, the ritual of the cigar, fascinated shaft, Knox person. I'm reading Race War Decoded, and when I saw the term Knox, the name Knox person, I thought not a person, and also I thought of a body. Another part, Havana, the size of a corn cob. It's so many. I can go on and on and on. Yeah, every line is like, oh, wow. And the narrator, whoever's narrating this book, I deeply appreciate. I appreciate them. They even belched when they did the part about the seven hot dogs. I was like, wow, that's interesting. I've never heard a narrator do that before. Another part that was extremely sexual, when Knox handed the money over to Shaft in the manila envelope, next to his chest and the bulge, and that whole description right there sounded extremely sexual. I'm just gonna leave it there as far as that part. I asked my victim mom, did she know about the book? She said no. Ask my victim uncle the same question. Nope. Victim grandmother, same question. No. And my victim mom, when I'm telling her about the book and that it was written by a white man, she started to get extremely, offended and aggressive. So, and I was like, wow, why? But yeah, that's all my notes for now. Thank you.
God, I can't move. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I can't move. I'm wounded. I'm wounded. I'm wounded. I told you I couldn't even get my composure together. I needed a timeout. Like, this is like one of the few times where it would have been, whoa, pause. Like, let's stop. We can't even do the rest of the audio. Like, wait a minute. You said you need, I might even have to take a timeout still. Like, I said more this week, man, when Mr. Fuller says that black people are worthy of great pity. Retarded. Stupid, primitive. Oh, every time I've, man, oof, 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 oof. You said you asked your attempted family members, hey, did you know this was written by a white man? Nope, nope, nope. Okay, you said you get to your mother, victim, and she said that you start, you know, telling her a little bit of the details about this book, Ernest Tidyman's project, what all this came from. You said she started. You said she got aggressive. Wait a minute. What did she get? I'm sorry, because it's not funny. Like, conflict between victims is not funny, but wow. Like, what did she get aggressive about?
She thought I was... about the whole, like... Oh, man. That it was black exploitation and how, you know, we... you know, it's all black cast or, you know, semi-black cast. And I'm telling her it's written by a white guy and the guy sounds gay. And she's like, no, no, no. You know, but look at Shaft. I was like, Mom, look, I mean, look at the name, Shaft. And she's like, what? I'm like, phallus? She's like, oh, why are you thinking like that? Your mind is dirty. And then that started getting offended. And yeah. I knew that was a white guy, and she didn't. It was just like, you know, what you see. The whole book is horrible. I don't care for it.
I'm sorry that the book produced some disagreement with you and your mom. That was not the intent of the book club, but whew, that is so, so kind. I think so many of us, we get she said your mind is dirty. Have you read, oh Lord Jesus, have you read Ernest Tidyman's book? What is his mind if your mind is dirty? And all she did was look at the name. Shad. That's what I've been saying the whole time. That's, I don't even like when people, they put all caps on social media and things or emails. Like, I never do that. Even for book titles and things, I use all caps when I spell out Shaft for that reason. Like, it's right in your face. Like, people can talk about all this and phallus. It's right in your face. Like, both ways. John Shaft. I said, keep that in mind from last week. What's a John? That's the person who goes and services sex workers, pays for sex workers, that sort of thing. It's both ways. It's right in the name. John. And then your mind, does she know Richard Roundtree Shaft? Like, is proud and is recognized as portraying the first gay interracial marriage on television in rock. Almost 30 years to the day. It was October 1991. Like, wow. But your mind is dirty. I'm sorry you had to endure that. Yeah, I'm giving you a big air hug.
No, it didn't get really tacky. Yeah, it didn't get too tacky. It was just like, I just felt the energy from her, like it was going to get there. So I was like, I heard and backed out of it. You know what, Gus? The Shaft, the title, Hidden in Plain Sight. Racism, Hidden in Plain Sight.
Mm. Mr. Fuller has it on the book. It says, many look, but few see. see what they're looking at. When you do, he has it at the front of all the books. You don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works. I mean, oh my God, to have, they just did a Shaft in 2019, Richard Roundtree and all. Generations of black people to brag about this. Worthy of great pity. Let me see if I can get my composure together. I'll see if other folks dialed in. Hopefully we won't have any more reports of even minor conflict with family members for the broadcast. Woo, let's see. I'll see other folks as I get hands. I'll kind of get my notes together. I'm really discombobulated, though. Like, wow, let me... It is kind of loosely following the movie, but not really. Like, there's some major edits. Like we said last week, they took out the Vietnam part. Like, the white cops hankering for black females, that is not in the movie at all. That he says, the commissioner's secretary was there too, and all the Jew hate. There were so many points. I was like, wait a minute, time out. And freaking Ernest Tidyman has a whole book, Shaft Among the Jews. It's like six books in this series. This is the first one that we're reading, and then he did five more of them. But that's a whole book, Shaft Amongst the Jews. I think his Jew hatred will come. He says, the commissioner's secretary was there, too. A nice-looking woman of about 40, Jewish. Andarazi liked dark women, like his wife. Even the faint shadow of mustache was intriguing, sensual to him. He liked hair, dark hair, black eyes. He liked this woman. Get him a cup of coffee now that you get immediately to that Welsing moment. All of this about dark women and dark hair and black eyes. And give me a cup of coffee. Dark women were... Oh, wait a minute. Let me get the whole thing. The commissioner was there at 4 o'clock. She was there at 4. She wasn't his secretary. She was his wife, the Jewish mother of them all. Why shouldn't she be there? He needed her, didn't he? Dark women were like that. You needed them, goddammit. They were there. His wife was like that. What? And this is coming from a white man? White author and white character? Now, he's talking about so-called Jewish. I mean, this sounds like some, like, melanin deficiency, melanin envy going on, color envy. The Grandcestor. So appreciate hearing what she had to say about this. I'm going to, like, I got totally lost my composure in this. I'm going to back up and try and do this the normal way and just go in order that I took my notes here. So, going back to chapter 3, Knox Parsons. I appreciate our female caller, Helen, in New York. She was talking about the names that made her think of non-person. Knox Parsons. It's not even Parsons. I think I said Parsons. It's not Knox Parsons. It's Knox Parsons. It made her think of non-person. In the film, they change this character, this black character's name from Knox Parsons to Bumpy. That's what they call him. It's still all the degradation and anti-blackness, but his name gets changed to Bumpy. But I did appreciate that. I wasn't thinking non-person, which is right there. But I mean, should have. A little slow. Retarded, worthy of great pity. But it sounded like a non-name. Like, John Shaft isn't a name either, to be truthful. But it just sounds like some white man sitting around. And what do we call, I think Tupac. Like, they have a scene from him, like, in the 90s. That's, like, 25 years after all this was published. where he's saying, I think he's with one of the Wayans brothers, and he's laughing, and they're like, Boogaloo, who came up with that name? Like, the white people are in a studio sitting around like, what are the Negroes calling themselves? Let's see. Boogaloo. Yeah, that's a good one. This has the same feel to it. Like, oh, I got to make up some Negro names. See, Knox Parsons, John Shaft, with all that sexual obsession there as well. So we go Knox Parson and all this about the cigar smoking. Now, there was cigarette smoking last week. There's a lot of cigarette smoking in the film. In the film as well. I totally agree. All of that is super sexualized. And there's a lot of literature, history. Dr. Welsing talked about that, especially with the cigar, not even a cigarette. And they don't just have him smoking any cigar. It's lots of detail about the type of cigar that he's smoking and all of that. I mean, phallic symbol all the way in Shaft. Next. Private Shaman saw a big Knox Parsons. Who the hell had he been talking to? He asked himself, shit. If she did half of what Parsons said she did, he had probably run into her 2 or 3 dozen times at parties while he had been pursuing somebody like Ellie. He tried to recall freaked out looking Negro girls who had caught his attention. A white man wrote this. He remembered too many. They were all over the place, like the fat-thighed Bronx bagel babies who shaved off their mustaches on Saturday night and flocked down to McDougal Street. He had tried a taste of both. Who could remember the faces and the bodies, let alone the names? She could have been one of them. Now, so many things I could say about that. Now, again, her mom said, you got a dirty mind. What? Like, Ernest Tidyman has a dirty mind. In fact, the whole persona of Shaft, this gigolo out having sex with white women, white men, black females, like, what? And his name is John Shaft, but this whole section, freaked out looking Negro girls. Ooh, that's two in a row. He didn't say ladies. He didn't say women. Freaked out looking Negro girls. Sounding like Woody Allen. A white man wrote this. Does he have some experience? Is he attracted to freaked out looking Negro girls? Does he spend some part of his time? Remember when Minister Malcolm X said in his autobiography, he said when he was Detroit Red, when he was not making the best decisions, he said, hey, I used to traffic. I used to do this. I was the pimp. I used to get white Johns who wanted black sex. Talked about that extensively in the early part of his autobiography. Ernest Tidyman, is he one of the folks that was doing that and then write or wanted to do it, writing about his fantasy for all of this? So we got, and this is like a major deviation in the movie. They do not have Knox Parsons in the movie is Bumpy. They do not have his daughter as being wild and rebellious or none of that. Quiet, innocent. She doesn't even really have a part in the movie. You just kind of see her in bondage, basically, by these white guys. We haven't got that far yet, but I mean, she doesn't really have a part. There's not as much detail, and there's no hint that she's been out doing something, you know, rowdy or whatever. But even, and it continues, the fat-thighed Bronx bagel babies who shaved off their mustaches on Saturday night and flocked down to McDougal Street, he had tried a taste of both. Like, man, the folks who were thinking about Ernest Tidyman, even what this is like in the 70s. Now, people talk about, hey, like, you don't have interracial marriages and couples and all that. Like, this is 1971. I think this might have even beat Roots coming. Yeah, this is before Roots even came out. And a white man is writing about all of this? Okie doke. Next, let's see. Persons might have screwed the little girl's head on straight with just one swipe of those huge paws. Generally, going back to Helen in New York, she said that Knox Persons, non-person, man not, woman not. Generally, people don't have paws. Animals have paws. why would it be that the way that, you know, he's going to be a father is to beat his daughter, not to be there and spend time with her, that sort of thing. Just beat her. Take your paw and beat her down like a cub beating his cub, a mother bear beating her cub. Ah. Non-humans, non-persons. That's the way black people, I think throughout the book, that's the way black people are conceptualized. You have to pay attention to that as we proceed. Actually, I take that back. This is in the movie. I'd have to go back. I wish if I had known, I could have pulled up the exact scene, but it's not stated with this much detail. Let me read the paragraph and then I'll try as best I can to give it the way it's stated in the movie. So Tidyman writes, and even his name, Tidyman, T-I-D-Y-M-A-N, Tidyman. This almost reminds me of Timothy Wise, like that's your given name on your birth certificate, Ernest Tidyman. Tidyman writes, and you, smart enough to go back and forth between black and white man. Doesn't say black man and white man, black and white man. That's what I'm asking you to do. I want you to think for me about this little girl, and I want you to go back and forth between being a black man and a white man and find her for me. It ain't going to hurt you none. And I got some ways to make it help you a whole lot to do that for me. Shaft had been called many things, even Tom, by some belligerent separatist, whatever that means. He had never been called a white man before. I'll pause there. Just a white man is writing this. That's again like, wait a minute. I don't even know what you're talking about, particularly in 1971. What do you even mean between going back and forth between being black, being a black man, and a white man? White man, explain what you wrote on that one. Like, how is that even possible? And this is articulated in the film, although it's not stated in the same way. So in the film, Bumpy, he goes to hire John Shaft, and he says something to the effect of, you know Harlem, you know everybody here, but you've got a foot in Whitey's trial. That's the way it's said there. You've got a foot in Whitey's trial, so you have access to both worlds. That way you can find out what's going on and get my girl back. That's the way it's said, not that you can be a white man and a white man, or that you can go back and forth between being a black man and a white man. Like, that is not said in the movie at all. I suspect having enough black people, Gordon Parks and Mr. Roundtree himself, Isaac, I suspect or hope that there were enough of them to be like, you know, come on now. I don't even know what. But I'm like I said, even it gets to the film. I said I had to look up in Whitey's trial. I had to look that up. T-R-O-U, I think it's G-H, T-R-O-U-G, T-R-O-U-G-H, or trough. And that's like something that animals eat out of. Like, that doesn't exist. I mean, metaphors. I'd have to get that to be explained to me. So this is Knox Parsons talking to Shaft. You can go back between both worlds. And then Shaft saying he had never been called a white man before. He'd been called a Tom. Now, again, so we have a white man talking about, yeah, I'm going to have this black character and black people have called him a Tom. Not that that hasn't been done before, but I mean, wow, where do we even get that from? No name calling. Let's see. Next one. The sexual metaphors and what have you are everywhere. Dr. Welsing, motherfuckers, that term is used. She had lots to say about the use of that term, especially coming from a white man in this one. Let's see. Shaft says, talking about himself, he was a figure standing alone on a foundation of corruption. His identity could become part of Shaft's. This is him talking about Knox Persons. His identity could become part of Shaft's identity, at least in the eyes of the police with whom Shaft dealt. Yet his power would also become part of Shaft's power. Shaft's power. Realistic about its seductive quality, wary of the chains, he was fascinated by the idea. Now, I just said they had his daughter in bondage. S&M, they call that. All the, you know, having someone for sexual pleasure, tied up and whips and all the rest of it. Now, right there, realistic about its seductive quality, wary of the chains. You got it right there. Chains and something sexual, seductive about Shaft's power. All of that just seems very phallus focused, very sexualized in the way that we're talking about this black male. Let's see. I totally agree. I had the same thing highlighted when Shaft is talking about putting the envelope in his pocket. We says Shaft stuck it into his own coat, feeling it bulge and nestle against the flat muscle of his chest. Like, come on. And then a white man is writing all this, and he spent all that time last. I said that, I put that in the email. You got this white man who spends all this time going into all this detail about black male bodies and his nude black body and looking at the scars and the muscles on his abdomen and torso and shit. Like, what is going on? He's got this scar on his hand and his face and the blackness of his skin and all the rest of it. Like, are you serious? Named Shaft? Let's see. I'll give out one more note and then check to make sure. The number again, 720-716-7300. Decode 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you have thoughts, observations on the first portion of the reading. Let's see. I'll get in one more. Let's see. The whole hot dog thing, even this hot dog scene is not as detailed as the book. But it is still in the movie. They have Shaft. He's at like a diner or some sort. And I think it's right after he's been hired by. But it's pretty much in line with what we read. It's right after he's been hired by, I said Bumpy, Knox Persons. He goes to this diner. He's sitting down. He has a hot dog. And he's eating it. And then a white guy, Andrazi, comes up and sits next to him. And he also orders a hot dog. And then, in fact, he says, give me a hot dog. Mustard, no onions. And he says, oh, wait a minute, hold the onions. Now, that's, you know, important for our purposes. Frequently, if people are on a date together, might be some kissing, sexual activity. Don't want to eat onions. Have that halitosis breath, right? And then you see it's kind of close. You can see both of them. Shaft is eating the hot dogs. Now, I thought then Dr. Welsing, she talks about hot dogs being a phallic symbol. The way that it gets described here, and plus he eats so many of them. He eats like seven of them. Who does that? He doesn't eat seven of them in the movie. He's one and leaves. And wait a minute, wait a minute. Might have to play that scene next week. He's eating the hot dog. The Andrazi comes in and is trying to get information from him. And he says, so where have you been? Shaft gets up from eating his hot dog, wipes his mouth, and he says, I got laid, which is his response repeatedly to enforcement officers. Where are you going? Going to get laid. Ha 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 ha. He gets his hot dog. Where'd you go? Oh, I got laid. And he leaves. So again, in my view, the symbolism of the hot dog phallus symbol right there, because that's what they end up talking about is sexual activity. But in the book, he writes out, so he gets seven hot dogs. He's surprised. Seven hot dogs. Shaft felt the bulge. Why are there so many bulges? Bulges in his chest. Bulges around his torso. Bulge of his stomach muscles at the bend, bulges near the groin area. Gotta make sure we pull your attention down if you didn't get it. He had been standing there thinking, and apparently had gorged on seven of the long red cylinders of meat and miscellany off the greasy grill. I'm gonna stop right there. Like, gorging on these penis symbols, it just seems so upset. And again, she had the audacity to say that your mind is dirty. Worthy of great pity. Let's see. Henry in Chicago should be with us as well. And then I'll look for other hands also.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I guess Knox Persons, As you mentioned in the movie, and I didn't see the movie, was renamed Bumpy. But from my understanding, his name was Bumpy Johannes. And I guess the character is supposed to resemble the real life Harlem gangster Bumpy Johnson. That's from what I read about Shaft the movie. And I guess in this book, too, even though he's named Knox Persons, if that's anything. I've also been trying to figure out, because if Tidyman is using the character of Knox Persons / Bumpy Johannes as a real-life character, I've been trying to figure out who Ben Buford is. He seems like some sort of, historical or real life character. I can't put my finger on it because the way he described him, he described him as a magnificent thing. So I'm assuming he's some sort of black person. He keeps talking about, revolutionary stuff, I guess. And he's got bodyguards and a minister of information. And I'm assuming he's something, somebody from the Nation of Islam. I don't know. Been trying to put my finger on it. If anybody else knows who he might be resembling, I would like to know, because he just seems like he's trying to describe him as a real person. So if anybody can chime in on that, or if Gus, if you have any ideas. I'm also trying to figure out, I don't know if we talked about this last week, is this book written for a black audience, a white audience, both? It kind of seems like this might have been written for, I don't know. If anybody has the answer to that one, that would be helpful. But I'm with the first caller. I'm not liking this book at all, even though it's full of sexual endos. Like you said, homoeroticism. I think you mentioned when Adrazi was talking about the commissioner's secretary. Adrazi liked dark women like his wife. I'm wondering if his wife was a non-white black woman. Faint shadow of mustache. Now, men who like mustaches, I don't know. I think somebody asked the question if the author himself was somebody of sexual confusion. So the $12 an hour, I did the inflation calculator, totals up to $84 in today's times. That is still low. I looked up the prices to hire a private investigator, and the ranges is like from like 90 to, 90 plus dollars an hour. I think $90 is like on the low end. So even back then, black people are getting underpaid, even though he is the quote unquote great Shaft. he called Persons a reverse racist. I'm always interested hearing that term, reverse racist. So we all know that this white man is practicing racism, or any white person who says that or labels any black person that type of term, even if it's fictional. So that's all I have on my mind.
Didn't he call him a reverse racist? Didn't he? And this is 1970. Like, I didn't even know they were using the term reverse racist in 1970. 50 years. Like, most of us on the line probably weren't even born at the time this book was published. And reverse racist. As for Buford's character, I don't know if this is like a white person just saying, hey, it's 1970. We've had, all these black people protesting and different organizations and what have you. The Black Panther Party is still around, functioning at this time, 1970, when he wrote this book, as are other organizations. So this could just be like a suspected racist composite of, you know, some sort of revolutionary black group. Type of a thing. It almost, the way that they're characterized, like both in the book and in the film, like in the book, I almost got the impression that they were into some sort of drugs by the way that they're introduced at the beginning of chapter four. Like you said, that's, I think, a great point about him saying Ben Buford's voice was a magnificent thing, non-person again. But Buford specifically, I don't know if there's, like, I was thinking he reminded me of someone from SNCC, maybe Black Panther Party member, maybe one of those two. The way that he's kind of presented as this so-called grassroots figure, and he's, you know, he's got this great voice and is going out and trying to organize and take it to Whitey and be underground and revolutionary and all these, whatever all these terms mean. But not going to be like, let's go to school and work within the system type of SCLC member of that time. That's the way it kind of comes across to me a little bit. But again, it seems like he has them engaged in some sort of narcotics, drug type activity when Ben is introduced. It's all, God damn you, motherfucker, I'm dying for you. Now get your ass out of here and get me what I need. And you get back here before 4 o'clock. That's when I need it. You go. Frightened, still not sure why he was frightened, he got up to leave. I'm going to try, Ben. I'm going to try. His assurance was as shaky as the knotted muscles in his gut. You try. You do that. You get back here by 4. The man left. The eyes of the others were on Buford. They watched his frozen mask of authority melt into a smile. You want to bet he gets back here with the shit? They smiled. It was no bet. The man, the pusher, would be back and would have what Ben Buford needed and wanted before he set off on another of his tours through the country. Now, I'm not sure. Now, just the fact that they call him the pusher, for that time, Superfly was days away from coming out and all the rest of it. But they don't have them connected to drugs. They just don't have them presented as logical, intelligent people, the folks who are with Ben Buford and his cohorts in the movie. You don't really hear too much from the people who work with Ben, but Ben himself is just presented as kind of this coarse, loudmouth, almost ruffian who's threatening Shaft and all the rest of it. Like, yeah, and they don't have, you know, too much coordination or whatever. Like, not a very powerful people. Like, I think that's almost shit. Like, if this is the Negro Revolution, like, wow, you all are kind of lame. That's the way that they're kind of presented in the movie and here, I'd say. Let's see. We'll see if any other folks have thoughts on Ben Buford, who these folks might represent, or anything else that stood out in the first portion of the reading before we get to the second session. Let me see. He says... that they would stay on the move, pop up and do a speaking appearance here or there, and just keep the FBI moving, keep the CIA moving. That is laughable. We just read Geronimo Pratt's autobiography, and particularly from a white man writing at this time, like, you know that is laughable. You have watched the assassination of Fred Hampton, which was before this book was published, the assassination of Medgar Evers, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Huggins, countless, Bunchy Carter, countless others, and the arrest of countless black people, whether they were in the Black Panther Party or not. So if you are a white man and you're in New York City, and he was a journalist, so it's not like Ernest Tidyman was just not paying attention and ignorant, you know, like, that is ridiculous. That is a total lie to think that these so-called black revolutionaries are a step ahead of the FBI and CIA. Like, give me a break. Let's see. Make sure I didn't see any other hands. Make sure I didn't miss maybe getting one more comment or no before we get to the second audio segment. I think the rock portion is important as well. I could see, in terms of having Richard Roundtree in the first televised interracial gay marriage, 1991 on Rock, I could see whites racists in Hollywood, like, oh yeah, we want to take Shaft with all the homoeroticism and all that, so-called virile black male, and yes, proudly have him as a gay black male with a white man, yes, and have their wedding on television, that this is Shaft 20 years later. Yes, I could see white people having that much of a memory, so that that'll be a part of his body of work when people check out Shaft. Let's see. I will stop there. Folks have additional thoughts, commentary on the book. Woo. Take notes. We should have lots more to discuss moving through Ernest Tidyman's work. Context of White Supremacy. We'll go ahead and get to the second audio segment. Again, take notes if you have additional thoughts, things you didn't get to share.
The red telephone on the desk began to ring. The hotline. The commissioner's hand streaked out. He scooped it from the cradle and up to his ear with the speed of a frontier gunslinger. Talk, he commanded. His eyes jumped to Andreozzi and back to the phone box as he listened. There was another phone just like that beside the commissioner's bed. Their only caller was Epic Disaster and all the forms of it New York contains. The commissioner listened for a minute and said exactly one word. Right. He dropped the receiver back on the red plastic box and looked at Andreozzi with a grim smile of a man who might be watching his own funeral procession go by. So much for conjecture. There's a gun battle going on at 139th in Amsterdam, and they're fighting it out with machine guns. Andreozzi felt gray all over, like a bag of unemptied vacuum dust. He almost forgot to put down the commissioner's coffee cup as they hurried out of the room together. Shaft got to the building at about 4 o'clock, just as he figured he would. It was a long drive down the Battery and back. Now, this place was about what he had anticipated, a scabrous slattern of a building, held together with an old mortar of dirt and decay propped up by the buildings on each side, both in the same clutch of despair. Some of the windows had been covered over with sheets of tin and were blank gray eyes on the night. A few of the uncovered frames held no glass and were just wind holes for the swirling puffs of soot that would drift in from the incinerators of better buildings of the area. But people lived behind some of those windows, if you could call them people, and if you could call that living. For Harlem, Shaft thought, you could call it the lower middle class. Ben Buford was on the fifth floor of five floors, in there behind the last door down the dark hallway toward the rear. He flashed almost immediately on the three, or was it four, figures in the darkness of adjacent doorways. Fools. Anybody who knew enough to look would pick up on them. They were about as inconspicuous as he might be at a Ku Klux Klan meeting in Biloxi. Why didn't they get up in the blank windows? Were they guarding Buford or advertising his presence? Or trying to get arrested as loiterers? Shaft gave no sign of spotting them. He waited for the frightened cab driver to get out of sight, then sauntered slowly across the street towards the entrance he had been told to seek. Shaft had anticipated the look of the place, the buildings like it. They had been his life until he had gone to soldier, not so much because Uncle Sam wanted him, but because a juvenile court judge and a probation officer wanted to get rid of him. He had lived in these buildings, slept in them, hidden in them, fled through them, lobbed the missiles of street warfare from their parapets. He remembered them well. Shaft had never felt nostalgic, at least never for anything of his childhood and youth, although he sometimes had a sad feeling that he thought must be like nostalgia over fantasies or thoughts of things he had not known. He remembered, yet he was still surprised when he went up to the chipped concrete steps and pushed open the door that was hanging like a broken arm on the entrance to an unlighted hallway. He was surprised at the smells. He had forgotten their assault waves against the senses. He never got that in Scarsdale, Greenwich, Westport, or any of those other little towns out along the island like Jericho. You didn't even get it in Manhattan unless you stumbled over a slum en route from antiseptic home to air-conditioned office. Urine. That was dominant. The peculiar, soft, mushy smell of rats, nesting, mating, scrabbling through the plaster. Age. Age has a rotten tone. Blended with dust and the smoke of old fires that may have eaten away at mattresses or the insulation on wiring and just the debris of paper and garbage in the corners of the basement. Finally, fear. Fear had an aroma, a light but pungent scent that pinched the sinuses as well as the spirit. How could he have forgotten all that when he had lived with it so long. Shaft went up the broken back stairwell slowly, carefully. Somewhere above him, there was a light, a single bulb glimmering into all this treachery of decay. Only the barest flicker of it reached him. He could not even see his own feet in the murk. They found their way up the stairs. Shaft avoided putting weight against the banister and tried to avoid brushing against the wall. When he stumbled on a loose board and his foot went through the backing, missing from one of the tread, he grumbled aloud, "Why the fuck don't they burn them all down?" He went to the recollection of an old corner friend named Jimmy, who had harassed a white cop on the beat along 125th Street between Lenox and 5th. Jimmy went to the cop every day, panhandling just for a penny. "Give me a penny, give me a penny, give me a penny," he would chant. "Why?" the cop asked once and only once. "Why do you want a penny, Jimmy?" "Jimmy, buy some matches. Jimmy, buy some matches." Chef smiled in the darkness. That door should be it. He considered giving the door a solid whack, a blow against the nerves of Ben Buford and his people. But he wasn't sure how edgy they would be. They had been bugged and rebugged, bugged in so many places by so many fools that this might be the moment when somebody answered the door with a 45 or a 30-30. So he knocked. Rap, rap, rap. In the way one neighbor might rap on another's door. "It's me, John Shaft, come to borrow a cup of tea." He bet Ben Buford had a cup of tea in there too. A pound of it. He hadn't been still long enough to make connections. Lonnie Dots opened the door. Shaft did not know him. He saw Ben Buford over Dots's shoulder, thinner, more elegant in his clothes than Shaft remembered him. A couple of other figures looking very much like Ben Buford stood with him. Shaft figured he better do the old friend routine. They all looked suspicious and nervous. "Hey, man," he said in Ben Buford's direction. "How you doing?" Shaft moved into the room without waiting for Dots to get out of the way. That was the man's choice. He either moved or got trampled. Dots moved. Shaft was into the room and extending his hand to Buford. "Hey," he repeated, smiling wildly, hoping without confidence that it was going across sincerely. "What you been doing?" Ridiculous. Everybody in the world knew what Ben Buford had been doing. He'd been throwing Molotovs of words on people, watching them ignite, seeing them explode in the fury of his indictments. Maybe the Florida swamp Indians didn't know what Ben Buford was doing, but that was all. "I have been doing just fine." Buford's voice was cold, precise, negative. The hand he permitted Shaft to shake was strong, but there was no warmth or welcome in the grip. There was rage and embarrassment in Buford's eyes. Shaft thought there might also be insanity. Hell, why not? Buford had to be insane to be doing what he was doing, putting himself on the line to get his head blown off. For what? For the revolution that wasn't going to work in this way? Shaft was convinced, but only in the total and eventual reorientation of a whole society. The other side was just as crazy in its way as Buford was in his. You couldn't bomb it out of them any more than you could shoot it out of Buford. Shaft marveled at the arrogance of their manner toward him. He wondered what they had read, what homework they had done to gather all that hip shit about revolution they urged on the black proletariat. They weren't going to lead him to the barricades looking like that, but they were certainly moving many others. God damned if he didn't almost expect Ben Buford's sweet, suffering mother to have a carbine under her mattress. And these cats, they were going to tell her to burn with it. Shit. He checked their faces one by one. Hostility, doubt, anger. The clothes were too pretty. Shaft leaned against the windowsill and thought with a twinge of embarrassment that his own suit must look like hell. Like in the morning, spilling coffee on himself, and now, closing out the night, leaning against a filthy windowsill about 3,000 hours later. In between, he had done just about everything but have a dogfight in a gray flannel single-breasted number that came from Paul Stewart's on Madison Avenue. Buford and the others were waiting. "Listen. All I want is to buy some information about a little girl that's missing," he said. "I figure you get around more than most people, so maybe you know this chick, heard about her." He was being honest as a man with 3 walnut shells and a round bean. They looked even more suspicious. "With Whitey's money?" Lonnie Dots asked. Shaft's threshold of annoyance was about 3 degrees lower than normal, probably because he was so tired. "You know," he said, "you pretty goddamn stupid." That was a wet towel across the face. "The money is green, and why in the fuck don't you find out what I'm buying before you say you're not selling?" Ben Buford came back at him hard with that great voice he threw out at college audiences. You can't come up here talking like that man. Shaft wasn't sure he could take all four of them, but he was sure he could mess up their clothes. Those fine suits trying to find out. They bored him with all this wasted hostility. He wasn't J. Edgar Hoover. His temper flashed and he sneered. Why, you silly mother. Sound roared up the stairwell with a sudden thunder of doom. There were four or five quick shouts, curses, then the shooting. The choppy prattle of machine gun fire, just like in the movies. Rat-a-tat-tat. Just like in a war. Pop, 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 pop. The others jumped to their feet. Fuck this, Shep mumbled. He looked out the window behind him to see if there was anything he could swing from, climb down, or hang on to. Nothing but five flights of suicide. They were firing in the stairwell now. More curses, feet running up the stairs, then stopping, then more firing. He didn't know how many pieces were in action, but it sure as hell was more than two. That was such a mad sound, such a bad sound. He looked back again. There was still nothing out the window but window. Shit. He had to get out and take them too, if he could. Where's the heat? He demanded in a shout. Four heads turned to him, questioning, surprised. Where are the goddamn guns? He roared. Got no guns here, Neufeld said. The silly bastards could run around and get beat up and arrested, smoke a lot of shit, make a lot of noise, but when it came right down to it, and it was coming right down to it this minute, they hadn't figured out how to lay a hand on a decent piece and save everybody's ass from getting shot off. Those people who were coming up the stairs, they knew where to get a piece. Let's get the hell out of the cigar box, Shaft commanded, moving towards the door. The door suddenly moved toward him. It flew open with a bang, and Shaft was staring into a collection of plumbing that looked like a commando machine gun out of World War II movies, a piece of pipe, an elbow joint, and a clip of 45 cartridges feeding into it. He stopped in mid-movement, hanging over the muzzle on the balls of his feet. Holding the gun in trembling hands was a 19 or 20-year-old cat in a leather jacket and black beret. His eyes were wide, near panic. Get the hell out of here, the young man shouted. Shaft wished the kid wasn't using the gun as a pointer, waving it toward the door, passing his middle on the way. What's going on out there? Buford asked. I don't know. They just came in. They wouldn't stop. Somebody said stop, and they started to shoot. Motherfuckers. Goddamn CIA, Neufeld said. Shaft checked them out for panic. Ben Buford looked calm enough. His eyes were bugging, and his face was filled with anger, but he was calm. Neufeld looked scared. Sweat covered his forehead and would soon be rolling around that pudgy face to the black goatee that covered his chin. Lonnie Dotz looked the same, but angry. He had the appearance of being permanently pissed off at the world. It wouldn't change if he were buying a pack of cigarettes or if, as now, he was buying a piece of death. The sons of bitches who were out to get him were all the same, and they were everywhere. Preston Pierce, a little shorter, wider than the others, looked more like himself. Looked like the most reliable of them, hooded eyes showing nothing, not moving, just standing there waiting to decide or for someone to decide for him that the play should be. There wasn't any time left for thinking. Shaft reached out and grabbed the kid by the shoulder of his jacket, spun him around and said, "Go, goddammit!" The kid went out the door, either under his own power or Shaft's push, the gun up and ready to work. "Let's get the fuck out of here," Neufeld said. "The roof," Lonnie Dotz said. "Up the roof!" They looked to Buford for a moment. "Okay," he said, "the roof." Dotz, Neufeld, and Pierce ran past Shaft to the door. Buford started out after them. Shaft grabbed him. "Wait a minute, wait," he said. "Not the roof." Buford turned on him, snarling. "Let go of me, you crazy bastard. We can get over the building and the hell out of here." Shaft's hand tightened on Buford's arm. Ben would have to tear it out of his socket to get away. "No, come on." He virtually dragged Buford out of the room by the stairs. The gunfire was two, maybe three flights down. It was one hell of a gunfight, too. Machine guns, on and off, for both sides were almost a steady roar. But that was the way to go. He started down the stairs, pulling the unwilling Buford after him. Buford struggled to free his arm. "No!" he cried. "You're taking me down there to get me killed! No!" Shaft was off balance at the top of the stairs, but he didn't have time to stop and argue. He turned to Buford, let go of his arm with his left hand, and turned it into a fist. He brought it up as hard as he could against Ben's chin. Even over all that gunfire, Shaft could hear the crunch of flesh on flesh, bone on bone. Buford's face danced across the skull. His entire body lifted up about an inch and then began to settle. Shaft pulled him forward and caught him over his shoulder. Then with a grunt of exertion, he turned down the stairs as quickly as he could move, with 170 pounds of anger over his shoulder. Ben Buford was his connection into an entire community within a community of the black world Shaft had to prowl to answer the question that Knox Pearson's asked of him. He wasn't going to let that connection go up on an open rooftop to be chopped down like a pigeon. Even if he had to carry Ben Buford through hell, he was going to keep the revolution alive. He started down the rickety stairs. "Silly son of a bitch," he muttered. 5. They had the roof figured. They were waiting. Lonnie Dots died with his arms thrown out as in supplication, a black minor Christ nailed to a rusty television antenna with .45 caliber spikes. Half of Preston Pierce's head vanished in that red cloud of the explosion that shattered him. Damon Newfield was cut through with a line of perforation that looked like a mistake by a giant machine turning out paper people on huge rolls. 2 sentries who had tried to prevent this lay lifeless in the street below. But Ben Buford lived. So did John Shaft. Shaft guessed they had exactly 3 minutes when the shooting stopped. The footsteps echoed up and then down the stairs. 3 minutes before the nearest radio car to get to the building and begin sealing it off. 3 minutes to run. He crawled quickly out from under the sway-backed bed, slithering across the gritty linoleum floor, pulling Buford after him. A spring caught at his suit, near the left shoulder. He swore, jerked hard, and tore loose, ripping the fabric. In 5 seconds, he was out, dragging Buford out, standing up, jerking Buford to his feet by the lapels of the fancy suit. The woman sitting on the bed seemed dazed. She was whimpering in fright and confusion, near hysteria, and about to let her mind leap over the edge into a howling abyss of madness. She had been torn half from the stupor of sleep by a gun battle in the hallways of her home. 2 men had kicked their way into her apartment. 1 man had. 1 was a body. She couldn't even scream. She was too frightened. They were black, and the man had just said to sit down and be quiet, and it would be all right. They crawled under her bed. The man stuffed the body under her bed and got under there with it. The shooting, all the shooting, it stopped, and somebody ran up the stairs and back down again, swearing. Now they were crawling out from under her bed. It never happened. She was in that bed sleeping, having the worst nightmare of her life. It never happened. "Come on, goddammit," Shaft said, jerking Buford to his feet, slapping the thin, slack-jawed face lightly with his left hand, trying to bring him around. "Wake up, Ben. We gotta run." Ben came around. He started to struggle as his eyes bulged open and rolled. Shaft held his arms. "Stop that shit," he said. "You're all right. The party's over. We got to run." Buford's anger settled into focus. He oozed hatred. That took 20 seconds. "No time to argue," Shaft said. "I just saved your fucking life. They're gone. Now we got to run. You going to go run with me, or do I carry you? You got any mother wit, use it, man." He was poised to clip Buford again, but Buford heard something in the silence that had returned to the building, something in Shaft's urgency that pressed harder than his distrust. He nodded. Shaft plunged his left hand into his pocket, came out with a small wad of bills. He dropped them into the woman's lap. "Try to forget you saw us," he said. "She would want to very much. She never would." 1 minute, move, run. If they were smart enough to be waiting out there, it was over. If they weren't, it was the only way. He couldn't let the cops have Buford. Shaft spun around from the dazed woman, who was looking down now at the crumpled pile of money in her lap, green against the thin pink fabric of her nightgown. He couldn't worry how Buford followed him now. It had to be now. It was years ago and they were running. They were together, but everybody was on his own. The blue was coming, coming with a scream of sirens and a flash of red to match the blood that might still be spilled. His blood, Buford's blood, any black blood. Run, goddammit, run. Shaft missed about 8 of the stairs going down, kicked a corpse stretched out along the railing. "Watch it there," he hissed at Buford, skipping the body, barely slowing. He saved those seconds for the doorway. Shaft stopped. The remaining glass was a handful of silvery shards on the floor of the small vestibule. Ragged holes pockmarked the frame. He stopped and looked out. Buford was right behind him, touching him, looking also. The street was empty, but lights were blinking on in the rooms of the tenements across the street. In another minute, heads would come poking out of those windows to see what had happened. The streets would fill. The law would be there. "I'm going out there so goddamn fast, nothing can get me," he whispered. "Stay with me." One great leap, he landed running at the bottom of the snaggle-faced concrete steps, running and crouched. He hoped to help Buford was in shape, hadn't been standing up to throw so many words that he had forgotten how to run. He landed and was away in a blur of motion. Now nobody could catch him. Nobody could hurt him. This was his way in the world. These dark streets were his place. An exultation of power fed his body from the pit of his stomach. He missed that. He ran, flew. They would find the alley, the doorway, the hidden place, in the moment that they needed it. They might be cornered in the rooms of Harlem, but not in the streets. This was really home. His 3 minutes were up. Shaft heard the sirens. They were all behind him. Then he saw the pulsating glow of the police car roof flasher, lighting the intersection ahead with the throb of its stained glass brain. The car was running without the siren. He sprang into a doorway, flattened against the shadows, and felt more than saw Buford leap in with him. They were breathing hard, sucking wind. The car swept past. They were out of the doorway, running again, close to the building to avoid so much as a glimpse in the patrol's rearview mirror. Eyes always looking ahead for the chance. Cop, the uncommitted squad car. They were near Broadway when Shaft finally flashed on to where they were going and what he was going to do. He pulled up to a walk, noted with satisfaction that Buford was breathing harder than he was, and that half moons of sweat darkened his jacket under his arms. "Hey, man," he gasped. "You got any subway tokens?" Buford began fishing in his pockets. Shock and action had worn him down to a simple reflex without thought. Shaft smiled, smiled in the chest-heaving, heart-pounding, brain-banging movement in the false dawn of Harlem streetlight, and acknowledged to himself and for himself his capacity to survive. Look at Buford. He talked about this, but he wasn't prepared for it. He was honking so hard his hand was shaking, spilling dimes into the street. Shaft reached out, held Buford's fistful of change steady, and sorted it out with a finger until he found tiny tokens hidden among the pennies. There'd be no attendant at the turnstile he wanted to use. "I'm going to take you to meet some friends of mine," he told Buford. "You make one fucking remark about any Tom shit to these people and I'll break both your legs." Then he turned and led the way towards Broadway and 7th Avenue IRT. He walked. It was maybe 4:45 or 5 o'clock. Anybody saw them now would figure they were just a couple of studs coming back from a party or a couple of Toms going off to sweep floors. If anybody handed him a broom right then, he thought, he'd climb up on the small end of it and sleep 24 hours. Shaft's face was gentle, open, snuggled against the pillow. It was more round than oval, more flat and concave than sculpted and convex. The eyes and nose seemed to have been cut into it rather than built upon it. It was almost a Polynesian carved face, cut into stained balsa or some dark wood. The lips were full, but they lay flat against his teeth, a mask, but not a mask. Even in sleep, there was life in it, life and strength. It was framed in a modified Afro haircut, notched with unexpectedly delicate and tightly set ears. The large, wide-set eyes of that face blinked open about noon. It had been an intense, deep sleep, taken from the morning hours by necessity as much as desire. He felt bathed in warmth and silence, secure and safe. White people woke up with that feeling almost every day. He had known it only since the discovery of his own power and strength. He could still savor and count his worth as a grubbing trash picker can count the treasure of unexpected discovery in the unlikely heap. Silence. He could hear Ben Buford's slow, easy breathing from the narrow, rumpled sheets and pillows across the room and see almost a third of a long, angular leg protruding out from under the sheet and light blanket at the bottom of the child's bed. Shaft got out of the bed without a sound, reached for his pants hung over the back of the chair, and pulled them on with a slight clink of keys and chain. Not enough to awaken Buford. Let the mother sleep for a while. Shaft padded out of the room on bare feet, feeling and enjoying the cleanness of the tiles. He promised himself he would clean up his apartment when he got back to it, to set up a system that would make his floors feel the same. It was good. The chicks who got out of his bed must feel like they were walking through the Sahara with all the goddamn grit and soot that he forgot to brush away or never had time to worry about. It was nice to feel a floor like this. The bathroom down the hall was spotless, too. He checked out the bright children's towels hanging on the racks as he stood urinating, digging the yellow plastic duck on the side of the tub. He could remember somebody soaping, rinsing, and drying him off as a kid. Who the hell was that among all the welfare department had shuffled him to as a foster child? Mrs. Eggleston? Mrs. Johnson? No. He flicked the handle of the toilet. Even that was gleaming, polished. Mrs. Underwood. She was the one. Nice old bitch, drank too much when the check came in. But she spent at least part of it on soap and a kettle to heat the water. The rest of them, fuck the rest of them, he thought, looking at his face in the mirror, twisting the taps together. He wanted to brush his teeth. He'd use one of the kid's half-sized brushes in the rack. The kid would never know. He felt a little guilty. He also felt a twinge of concern. All the married people he knew said that the only thing you got out of the first 10 years of kids was a variety of diseases they brought into the house. Which kid had that cold? Fuck it. He picked up the least frazzled of the brushes, the bright red plastic one, and brushed while he traced the roadmap red that patterned his eyes. Any sleep was enough sleep, but he wished he had been able to sleep longer. He hoped the kid didn't have anything serious. Could you catch tooth decay from somebody? No. Every time he went tongue diving with a fox, it would mean, well, hell, he wouldn't have a tooth left. Well, fuck it. Anybody who had a house this clean wouldn't have a kid with a lot of diseases anyhow. He spat out the Crest. That was awful tasting shit. But there was something in it that was good for you. He'd ask Helen, kind of casual, how the kids had been lately. He put the toothbrush back on the rack, sloshed water onto his face from the cups of his broad, meaty hands. He would borrow Marvin's razor later. Shaft padded out of the bathroom, poked a head into the bedroom to note that Ben was still out and snoring lightly. He pulled the door almost shut. He wasn't sure he liked Buford much anymore, or if there was anything there to like or dislike. He either joined him or fought him. Who liked Lennon? Probably nobody but his mother. Shaft turned and headed towards the dish and water noises from the kitchen at the end of the long carpeted hallway. Hey, baby, he said to the young woman at the sink. You got any coffee in this joint? Helen Green turned, smiling. She nodded toward the stove. It'll be done dripping in a minute. I heard you in the bathroom. Did you get enough sleep? Enough, he said, yawning and stretching his arms up and almost touching the ceiling of the apartment's rooming combination of a place to cook it and a place to eat it. All the muscles of his torso rippled upward, and the highest of the bullet scars peaked over the top of his belt like a lost and wandering navel. You shouldn't do that to a grown woman this early in the day, she said, walking over to the stove with a brown pottery mug, then juggling the hot Chemex filter in two fingers while she poured his coffee with the other hand. He broke the stretch with a laugh. Shit, he said. All I have to do is look at you wrong, and Marvin is going to fix up my tax returns so good I'll never see the outside of Danbury Jail. Shaft sat at the edge of one of the tube steel chairs, his elbows on the plastic surface of the table, counting the equipment of normalcy in the kitchen. He did it every time he came here. The bright blue canisters at the shelf beneath the cupboards, the cooking timer beside them, the glass and the plastic blender plugged into the socket behind the toaster, the swing-out can opener attached to the cupboard beside the window over the sink, the chalk messages on the blackboard beside the door in the hallway. There was a place for everything in his need to see and be part of this middle-class scene of domesticity, and everything was in its place. Got a new frying pan, green stamps from the grocery store. He pasted them in a little book, and they turned them into frying pans, bathroom scales, things like that. Oh, yeah. Is that what they teach you up in Vassar? What's that? She sat down with her own cup, looking genuinely puzzled. They teach you how to lick all them itty-bitty little stamps and paste them in a book. How would you like a hot cup of coffee over the head? He laughed. She picked up a pencil from the table and began to make notes on a small pad in housewife's shorthand. Cough, veg, pap towels, hive dish. Shaft chewed at the blunt edge of the coffee mug and watched her make out the shopping list. She was the least black Negro he knew, possibly the most attractive, possibly the most feminine and womanly as well. Marvin Green was a fortunate man to have her as a wife and the mother of his children. He, John Shaft, was equally fortunate to have them both as friends and the caretakers of the one sanctuary to which he might retreat from the churning, snarling city. He couldn't really stand it for any length of time. The whole domestic scene was a huge pain in the ass, an irritant that grated against everything he felt about conformity and isolation of both spirit and flesh in the soft death of the suburbs. But he also needed an occasional drafts of the warmth and viability of it, the continuing stability of its values, however boring. It was the underside of the world, the antithesis and the opposite. It had been the one place to run when there was no place else to go with Ben Buford. Helen paused in mid-vegetable, turned from the shopping list to look at him seriously and hesitantly. "There's been a lot of talk about this on the radio," she said.
"Like what?"
5 men were killed. I think they said 3 on the roof and 2 in the street. He had figured it would be something like that, but the vital statistics of it shook him. "I wish it had been more," he said. Helen Green's eyes widened, her mouth turned down with dismay and shock. Shaft could be brutal and violent. That was his world. But he was not totally brutal and violent in a person. Not to her. "Yeah," he said, getting up and moving toward the stove for more coffee. 5 of their people for 5 of ours. Maybe something like that. She had turned to look at him, twisting around in the dinette chair, not quite believing that she was listening to a man in her kitchen wish for 5 violent deaths. "Oh, shit, Helen. If we're going to fight a revolution, if we're going to start waving guns around like that, why in the name of hell doesn't somebody learn how to use the damn things? Nowhere in the world should 5 men die without taking 5 with them, if that's what it's going to be."
"Johnny, are you all right?"
"Hell no, I'm not all right. Neither is anything else in this fucked up world." He wished he could tell her how grateful he was that there had been a place where he could run from it. From everything else in the fucked up world, the calm condition of her home, her kitchen. For some reason, he couldn't do that. The words stuck in his throat. And even the hot, strong coffee he gulped was no help in dissolving them. He was even avoiding the concerned and sympathetic hazel eyes with which she followed him across the black and white tile floor. He'd better go get Buford up. He reached for another mug out of the cupboard and poured coffee into it.
"John, who were they trying to kill? You or him?"
Shaft wished he knew. The 6.5-foot egomaniac, bent and folded into a 5-foot child's bed down the hallway of this middle-class apartment, would awaken with righteous certainty that he alone was the target, the total enemy, the Lobo Messiah. That was too simple. Shaft was glad she had asked. It reminded him to keep thinking while she wrapped him in the security blanket of the home. Shaft walked back to the stove with the mugs, poured Ben Buford's coffee back into the pot. He wanted to make a couple calls before he renewed the confrontation with Ben. Helen had put the essential question to him. Buford's answer to it wasn't going to be good enough. "What time do the kids get home?" he asked.
"About 3:30. They want to see you." They were tickled you and Buford were sleeping in their beds, Papa Bear and Angry Bear.
"Hey, good. What about Marvin?"
"Maybe 5:30. He'll call and he'll let me know. Maybe a little earlier because you're here.
Tell him not to change his routine." She frowned again.
"Oh, cool,"
Shaft said, putting the extra cup in the sink and walking over to touch her shoulder. "Nobody's coming in here to shoot anybody. I mean, he shouldn't screw up his day. We'll be going about 10 or 11. Plenty of time to talk."
Helen Green, who was a Negro girl, 2 or 3 generations removed from the blackness of skin and soul that had brought Shaft to her kitchen in flight, raised her hand to the one on her shoulder and held it gently for a moment. "This frightens me," she said.
"You ain't the only one. But nobody's after you. Maybe not even me. And nobody knows he's here. Relax.
I got to use the telephone."
There was an extension telephone in the kitchen. Shaft guessed it would be easier on Helen to hear little or nothing of what he had to say. He filled his mug with a 3rd cup of coffee and started for the living room to make his calls while settling on Marvin Green's big leather chair.
"John," she said.
"John, I..."
"Hmm?"
He
He paused at the entry from the kitchen into the long hallway, past the bedrooms into the living room, turned and faced the questions in her eyes. Nothing, I guess. What do you think Ben would want for supper? That mother's so mean he don't eat, Chas said. He lives on hate. What about you? Steak, he said. Dipped in flour and fried. Ugh.
Context of white supremacy. So that's what we will pick up at for next Thursday. We did not quite get all the way out of... See, I think we're still in chapter five. We're still in chapter five, but we'll pick up there for next Friday. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Written by a white man. I just want to say real quick before I get to folks who dialed in to see if they have thoughts, observations on the second portion of the reading. I think it was Henry in Chicago. He was commenting about the use of the term reverse racist. I think this is important because he's not used. Normally, when I've heard reverse racism used, it means black people or someone mistreating white people. That's the way that I've generally heard it used, that this is some form of reverse racism. That is not how Ernest Tidyman is using the term reverse racism. He's using it meaning mistreating other black people, which I've never heard. Reverse racism meaning a black person mistreating other black people. Like, I'll read it again. Or read it the first time. I didn't read it last time. So this is Andrazi. And he's talking to another white officer. So he says, he's talking about Andrazi talking about Knox persons. But he's never been involved in anything that so much as suggested that he wanted to change Harlem or the white community or anything else. His whole life, his whole world is built on the attitudes that made the opportunity for him to function. If anything, persons would have to be a reverse racist. He probably has a deeper appreciation of the status quo than Lester Maddox or George Wallace. George Wallace was a former governor of Alabama, presidential candidate at one time, staunch racist white supremacist, stood in front of the University of Alabama to block Negro interest, Negro students, staunch racist white supremacist. He couldn't prosper. Might be Mississippi. Might have my states wrong. I was thinking Alabama, but... Yeah, might be Mississippi. I could be wrong. One of those southern states. I'll make sure I get the correct one. He couldn't prosper in anything but a tight black community with its corruptible white cops on the take and the whole feeling that it's all right to go ahead and do those black things like shoot craps, drink gin, play the numbers, just so you do them on that side of the line. So his presence negates the racial angle, at least to me. Fascinating passage all the way around. Wow, black things. Unfortunately, it seems many of these are still thought of as black things, niggardly existence. But see, it sounds like he's saying reverse racist, meaning... Hey, I like what we have. Let's keep it in place. And I'm just mistreating black people, you know, with my criminal activity. That's what it sounds like, unprecedented, at least for me. I don't hear people say reverse racist, meaning a black person mistreating other black people. Anyway, let's see if folks have any thoughts, observations on the second portion of the reading, or if you had reverse racist, if you have thoughts on Ben Buford, if you were able to talk to any of your parents, other black people, ask them if they knew all of this was based on a book by a white man, and if that impacts how they remember this beloved series. Let's see. Helen in New York, Henry in Chicago should be with us, and then I'll look for other hands as I see them. And feel free, I think Henry in Chicago was the one he said he was not liking this book. You can feel free to give your view if you think, you know, this is not constructive at all. We're in the middle of a health pandemic and reading this, you know, nonsense from 50 years ago. Feel free to share that as well. But see, Helen in New York, Henry in Chicago with us. I'll look for other folks as well.
It's not that I think the book is not constructive. I just don't like the book. I don't like the story. And knowing that that is written by a white guy, that sounds sounds like a homosexual to me. Then, yeah, that's... Oh, the only thing I want to say about this part, especially what you just read, this person does not sound ignorant. Ernest Tiedemann does not sound ignorant. No, he does not. That's all I wanted to say. Mute my line.
Can't be ignorant about white supremacy racism and be classified as white. 1970, 2020, doesn't matter. Henry in Chicago, I'll look for other folks as well.
Yeah, I share the sentiments of Helen. It's not like the book may, you know, it may be constructive. I personally don't like it either. It's just my personal preference. And also too, you know, you played earlier about Richard Roundtree and his role in Rock, playing a gay black man. I was looking at Richard Roundtree's acting credits, and right after Shaft, he plays in this movie called Embassy, which is actually also based off of a novel as well that was written in 1969. And Roundtree played a CIA agent, which was kind of interesting considering, it's the early 70s. I didn't hear about this. I don't know, because it was kind of like a British film. Also, too, in the, you know, kind of like in the middle, you know, in the beginnings or the, probably in the middle of the beginnings of the James Bond films, you know, and he played a CIA agent, which was interesting because I think last week I mentioned The Spook Who Sat by the Door, which was a novel and a movie that was written around the same time. Also, you know, a former black CIA agent in that movie. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I didn't have anything for the second audio, but that's all I had in my mind.
Fascinating. Did not see that one. Embassy. That is interesting. Well, I guess now that was some years after I Spy with now, they'll say, disgraced Bill Cosby. So at least a large segment of the television audience had seen like a black, like secret agent type person before in Bill Cosby. So, and then with the success of Shaft and everything, like, yeah, I could kind of see that at that point. But I mean, even still, like, that's, you know, wow. Embassy. Have to see, have to check that one out. I don't know. I don't like this either. I didn't like The Hate U Give either. Second worst, or formerly worst book ever. But it's so fascinating to me just reading this. And like I said, like not knowing that this was based on something that a white man wrote all of these years. And so kind of rewatching the film with that knowledge. And then to find that there's not really analysis of this in terms of all of the homoeroticism and sexual symbolism, and why would a white man write a book like this? Like, that is, it's staggering on a lot of levels, worthy of great pity. Let's see, some of the notes that I took from the second portion of the reading. Let's see. They even have the white enforcement officers talking about getting Negro informers. We talked a lot about that when we read Geronimo Pratt's biography. Let's see. Got that one. When they talk, he goes into detail about the dilapidated shack where Ben Buford lives. And he says, for Harlem, Shaft thought you could call it a lower middle class. Ben Buford was on the fifth of the five floors in there behind the last door down the dark hallway toward the rear. And he talks about all the decay of the building and the rats and disrepair and all of that. Like I said, it's not as though Ben Buford and these folks are presented and then all of this areas, that's another thing that stands out to me. Like, they, even in the movie, it's kind of clear that this is not like a well-to-do area, but Shaft is just kind of bopping through in his leather jacket. He doesn't even have a car, you know, he's just walking through in his leather jacket in the midst of all this filth. Like, anyway, so Ben lives in the dump. Let's see. The imitating the narrator, Will Dixon. So one of our listeners investigated. I was able to see an image of what is reportedly Mr. Dixon, the narrator. I thought this was someone classified as white, or I suspected it could be, but I wasn't sure. The voices can, you know, that's not reliable. Images can trick you too. But the image that I saw, the narrator, Mr. Dixon, looks like someone. Oh, wow. Helicopter. Amazing. Military, I guess. Who knows? But the image that I saw that is allegedly Mr. Dixon looks like, I said, he looks similar to President Obama. I don't know if he has a white parent, but it looked like someone who would be classified as not white, although I would not be surprised if he had a white parent. That was my conclusion. I think the person who found the image also said, I think this is someone who'd be classified as not white. White parent, maybe. I said racially ambiguous. That was what I said. Racially ambiguous. Some other race. I said that was the popular category. That notwithstanding. The voicing of some of these voices when they have Jimmy, give me a penny, all that is reminded me of the Turner Diaries, where they have similar thing, a white narrator voicing black people. Let's see. Got no guns here, Newfield said. The silly bastards could run around and get beat up and arrested, smoke a lot of shit. See, they have them as dope. They're on narcotics of some sort. Make a lot of noise, but when it came right down to it, and it was coming right down to it this minute, they hadn't figured on how to lay a hand on a decent piece and save everybody's ass from getting shot off. Those people who were coming up the stairs, they knew where to get a piece. The sexual symbolism, a piece. Sometimes people say that about getting sexual intercourse, access to sexual intercourse, and then get their ass shot off in the middle of all of this critique of these pseudo black revolutionaries who have no guns and all of that, which probably would have been an accurate critique of many so-called radical or militant black organizations at that time, that they certainly, in comparison to white people, much less the police and SWAT and U.S. Army and all the rest of it, no, they don't have any guns and arms too short to box with God, they say. Let's see. Not ignorant. One of the black folks in the group is Preston Pierce. It's the PP would be the initials, Preston Pierce. Just paying attention to the names. Let's see. Next, beginning of chapter 5. Man, this is in the movie. So it's very graphic, the death of these black people. They had the roof figured. They were waiting. Lonnie Dots died with his arms thrown out as if in supplication, a black miner Christ nailed, didn't even capitalize Christ, nailed to a rusty television antenna with 45 caliber spikes. Half of Preston Pierce's head vanished in that red cloud of the explosion that shattered him. Graphic. Bayman Newfield was cut through with a line of perforation that looked like a mistake by a giant machine turning out paper people on huge rolls. What detail. Now, in the movie, you get the exact same Negro gore they come and shoot and kill all these black people, and they have to make a big dramatic showing, and oh, dead Negroes, and let's see, the next one. Oh, so they, this is in the movie, they, during the midst of this escape, Shaft and Ben Buford, they break into the residence of a black female. And so she's half asleep and, you know, doesn't know what's going on. So in the book, they have it written out, she had been half torn from the stupor of sleep by a gun battle in the hallways of her home. Two men had kicked their way into her apartment. One man had, one was a body. Now, even that's, what? A white man is writing about Shaft and Buford. Now, you figure out which is which. Two men had kicked their way into her apartment. One man had. One was a body. I'll say Shaft was the man, so-called, and Buford was the body. But, I mean, wow. She couldn't even scream. She was too frightened. They were black, period. I mean, that's a white man writing. Oh, my gosh. Negroes have not just anybody's breaking in. I don't know if they're white, black, whatever. Someone's working. Oh, my God. Negroes. Ah. Right on, Tidyman. But this is in the movie where they break in and they give her some money for breaking the door and all that. Incidentally, in the movie, Ben Buford grabs her knitting shears and threatens Shaft. At this point, he thinks Shaft, like, set them up to be attacked. And Shaft gets insulted, like, you know, don't threaten me and don't call me some, you know, traitor, Judas, whatever it is, and, you know, smacks the shears away from him, walks away. But they pay the black female and keep it moving. Let's see. Next. Jesus. Shaft talking to Ben. Come on, goddammit, Shaft said, jerking Buford to his feet, slapping the thin, slack-jawed face lightly with his left hand. That's generally slacked. Like I said, Ben is not portrayed well. If this is supposed to be black revolutionaries or Tidyman's perception of them, like, generally people talk about someone who is slack-jawed, either they're, you know, maybe in some sort of drug-induced stupor, but that's just having your mouth open wide, where you're kind of drooling or whatever it is, not really paying attention. Like, that is generally not the look of intelligence and a logical, thinking, highly functioning person. Let's see. The word oozed. I pointed this out twice in the reading of Apropos of Nothing, Woody Allen. Oozed being used as a descriptor when talking about a black person, that they oozed something. And we got it here again. That's two books in a row. Tidyman says Buford's anger settled into focus. He oozed hatred. Well, I don't even know what that means. Like, they just, that's why I said, like, Ben's character is portrayed in such a grisly, inhumane manner. And it's, his character's like that in the film too. And then so they give you all this gory depiction of these dead black people. And then Shaft goes down the stairs and he kicks one of the black bodies. But it's like, hey, watch it there. Like, you're stepping on our black brothers. Now, that's not in the movie per se. In the movie, they have a scene where Ben kind of looks down. It's like, oh, my gosh, they killed so many black people. Shaft tells him quickly, like, hey, no time to count your dead. Let's go. And they keep on. But they give lots of long camera shots on dead black people. Let's see. He says that, so they're going out, it's almost 5 a.m, so if anybody saw them now, would figure they were just a couple of studs coming back from a party. Sexual connotation, maybe even homoerotic? Let's see. Shaft's face was gentle, open, snuggled against the pillow. It was more round than oval, more flat and concave than sculptured and convex. The eyes and nose seemed to have been cut into it rather than built upon it. It was almost a Polynesian carved face cut into stained balsa or some dark wood. The lips were full, John Gruden, but they lay flat against his teeth. A mask, but not a mask. Even in sleep, there was life in it, life and strength. It was framed in a modified Afro haircut. Now, again, this is a white man with all this detail. about this Negro face and body. Let's see. And then we got to go into detail about Shaft urinating, getting back to the black genitalia. They mentioned Shaft after urinating, or while urinating, they mentioned Shaft grew up in foster care. Now, that's fascinating because that is also totally excised from the film series. He's not in foster care. He's not in Vietnam. Like, they remove all of that, where he's talking about he couldn't remember someone rubbing soap on him, and talking about these drunk females. Who knows if they're white, non-white? Like, wow. Throwaway children, and that's even something to think about more, like a white man writing about a black boy growing up in foster care to become Shaft. Even the sexual molestation of children that happens in these environments, Shaft indeed. And then he says, so they're staying in the house, this black female, Miss Green, she's married. They don't show Marvin in the movie. They just allude to him in the movie. You don't know if Marvin is the son or her husband. It's not even explained. Just this black person asleep. But Shaft doesn't sleep there. Shaft just deposits Ben at the Green residence and leaves to go do Shaft things and then come back to retrieve Ben. So in the movie, they go there. They both stay in the child's room. He gets up. Goes out in the morning. She gets up to put on coffee, and she asks how much sleep you get. Enough. All the muscles of his torso rippled upward, and the highest of the bullet scars peaked over the top of his belt like a lost and wandering navel. Again, we go right back to the genital area. You shouldn't do that to a grown woman this early in the day, she said, walking over to the stove with a brown pottery mug, then juggling the hot Chemex filter. He says, shit, all I have to do is look at you the wrong way and your husband will flip out. Now, to me, this seems like a sexual thing. Very much so. The whole description and all that, again, with the white man. But then, when he yawned and she could see his torso, like, oh, my goodness. Like, all that flashing, you know, like, what in the world? Like, none of that is in the movie. And again, a white man writing about all this, every page, sexual activity. Who is this book written for? It's reported that the book series did not sell really well, even after the movie and all that. I guess it wasn't that type of thing where people saw the movie and, oh, let me go read the book. That didn't happen. And the book was out of, in fact, it did so poorly, the book was out of print for some time. They said it wasn't even, you know, moving 10,000 copies a year or what have you. So, audience, I guess not very many people read the books, apparently. I don't know who it would be intended. Maybe white people. That's who I'm thinking. Like, would a white man write this sort of book thinking, yes, black people will buy? Now, Spook Who Sat by the Door had already come out at this point. So, you know, as did, like, Eldridge Cleaver's book, Soul on Ice, and that sort of thing. So, he could have been thinking, yes, maybe it'd be great. You know, black power type novel with this character. Maybe. But I think Ernest Tidyman, I think he would have known that white people would enjoy. I mean, a lot of white people like Shaft. A lot of white people. The 70s series, tons of white people went to those movies. So maybe he was thinking white people would buy the book. I don't know. People have to think. Let's see. All the, he says, Shaft chewed on the blunt edge of the coffee mug and watched her make out the shopping list. She was the least black Negro he knew, possibly the most attractive, possibly the most feminine and womanly as well. I don't even know what to make of that coming from a white man, talking about this being the least black Negro. What does that even mean? It's not even specified. Like, what? Who's the most black Negro? Who's the most in-between black Negro? And then he's got Shaft going from black to white. Like, what? Let's see. All of this, five should die for five of theirs. Like, that's not in the movie at all. Again, a white man is writing about all of this. Let's see. Those are all the notes I had for the second audio segment. I guess I'll give one more check to see if folks have any thoughts from the second portion of the audio we heard today, or if they are satisfied with the reading for what we heard, at least for today so far. I am flabbergasted. Significant. There's significant differences from the film, and then just wow, reading this and seeing where some of the parallels are to the kind of sexual things that are hinted at and the anti-sexual behavior that's kind of rife throughout the text. It is fascinating. I can only say again, once you kind of grasp sometimes the origin, the genesis of a lot of things that we think of as being authentically Black are actually with someone classified as white. Investigate everything. Try to do as much research as you possibly can. So many things are similar to this, where we are trained, conditioned to brag about and think about this as something grand and spectacular and great, and it is nothing of the sort. So folks are satisfied? Grand. We will pick up next week. Feel free to email untiljustice@gmail.com if you have thoughts, observations. We'll share them. This book is not very long. We'll probably only have five sessions max, so we should be done very quickly and then moving off to other books, Elizabeth Holmes or whatever it is. With that, we'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism, John Gruden, No Porn at Work. Very important, and other lessons, and even the vaccine mandates. Crazy times on the plantation. Much obliged to the folks who tuned in. Hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. Sobriety would be best. Had some alcohol consumption, drugs and such in the book. We will need high-thinking Black people, victims of racism, to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled if we're going to go out, going any place or what have you. If you are out and about, be alert. There are lots of hostile, rowdy whites and non-whites out and about. Someone is being rowdy and loud. You do not want to engage. You should be thinking this person could be armed. Exit. In fact, this person could be armed and they could have an entire entourage armed with them. You are like Ben Buford and company. You don't have firearms. Exit. You do not want to be getting into some verbal confrontation. And then, oh man, I did not leave my residence prepared to kill and or die. That's it. If you're going out, if you're driving, you're sober, buckled, and you are not on the phone. Again, we need all of our attention so that we can be as mindful as possible about what is happening around us and minimizing contact with race soldiers, badge or no, as best we can. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.